Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care to order. It's December 14th, 1 p.m., Hearing Room B. And I am delighted to have the final committee meeting of 2010 and looking forward to the committee in 2011.
Oh, we're going to do it again?
We're going to do it again.
Two committees in one, I know.
But I do want to start out by saying that this is the last health policy committee that Senator Morissette is going to be on, and he has been such a valuable member of the legislature, let alone being such a passionate person in health care. He has provided so much input and has been so effective in meeting the needs of health care in Oregon. And I am going to miss him. I am really going to miss him because
you're taking my workload.
I'm taking his workload, exactly. But he also, we divided up the issues pretty evenly, and he loved what he was doing, and I loved what I was doing, and now I have to love what he was doing, so we'll see how that works.
Well, you have crossed the boundary into becoming a almost senior citizen now, right?
That's right, this month.
So that means that you have to start thinking more like a
senior. All right, I will try to do that.
I reject that concept.
Well, with that, we are very honored to have some extremely valuable people on the use of dental therapists in Oregon that are from Alaska and from Boston. This, again, is going to be a very controversial topic, but we want to keep the politics out of it for this hearing, if that's possible. The oral health needs in this state are not being met. And so we are wanting to look at alternatives in dealing with it. It was so wonderful that the dentists of Oregon provided free care at the convention center, and there were thousands and thousands of people lining up in frigid weather. I mean, the lines went all around the convention center wanting to get oral health. And I believe Elizabeth Kushwa was telling me that over half of the absences in schools is due to oral health issues. So it's an issue that we need to look at, and I would like to call Judith Woodruff, Dr. Albert K. Lee, and Dr. Tom Bornstein to the front. And if you then, each of you, would give just a little bio of who you are, and that would be very helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Judith Woodruff. I'm from the Northwest Health Foundation. I'm the Director of Workforce Development, and I have been there for almost a decade now, and have been working on workforce development nearly all of that time, most primarily with nursing workforce development in the last 8 years. To my left is Dr. Tom Bornstein. Dr. Bornstein is a dentist from the state of Alaska. He earned his dental degree from the University of Maryland and completed a residency in advanced general practice at the Alaska Native Medical Center. Dr. Bornstein is the director of dental services for Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium in Juneau, Alaska. To his left is Dr. Albert K. Yee. He is a physician and is the Senior Project Director, Health Advisor for Health and Human Development Division of the Educational Development Center in Boston, Massachusetts. He leads the planning and implementation of projects to improve the health of targeted populations, and he most recently held a leadership roles in public and community health and health care at the Kellogg Foundation of Battle Creek, Michigan. Dr. Yee was also Regional Health Administrator for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and has worked in integrated health systems and community health center. And we are here to discuss the state of oral health in Oregon and some alternative solutions to that issue. So thank you for having us. I just wanted to open with a bit of information about the state of oral health here in this state and why the Northwest Health Foundation is interested in this. 10 years ago, the U.S. Surgeon General issued a report indicating that oral health is vital to the health of all Americans, and that one of the issues that we have is that we see it as a separate function of health rather than an integrated part of our health. Oral health refers to the health not just of the teeth and the gums, but also the hard and soft palate, linings of the mouth and throat, the tongue and lips, salivary glands, chewing muscles, and upper and lower jaws. And I think we have a tendency to think of it as purely as a dental issue around teeth rather than around a whole oral health problem. Oral health disease compromises our ability to thrive, and left untreated brings pain, lowers productivity, and increases our risk for other diseases. Among children, oral disease is 5 times more common than that of asthma. And Madam Chair realistically pointed out, it is also one of the leading causes of school absenteeism is left untreated. Between 25% and 30% of all Oregonians do not visit the dentist at least annually. 22 of Oregon's 36 counties, that's 61%, endure some type of shortage of dental professionals. So it's very important to the rural areas and the areas where we don't have a lot of providers to really begin to address this issue. I want to talk a little bit about children because I think that's one of the areas where people feel the greatest need. According to the Oregon Smile Survey, which was performed by the Oregon Department of Health Services in 2002, which is the most recent information, a survey of 6 to 8-year-old students, over half of Oregon children already had cavities. Almost 1 in 4 have untreated decay. Nearly 1 in 20 are in urgent need of care. That means that they are in an urgent situation where they need either immediate care or within the next few days. 1 in 4 has not seen a dentist in the previous year. And children from low-income families are 3 times more likely to report having trouble accessing care. And non-white children in Oregon experience dental caries and untreated decay at a higher rate than their white counterparts. Those are some of the statistics that led our foundation to begin studying the issue. For those of you who know us, you know that we don't jump into issues lightly, and we have been looking at the issues around oral health for a number of years, starting primarily with the fluoride issue for the state of Oregon. I personally have been studying this issue of providers and increasing access to dental care for the last 2 years. And so with that information, we brought to you some experts to talk about some alternative models of care that the state of Oregon might consider as we move forward. I've prepared for you some materials in your in a packet that I just want to point you to and give you some information about why they're included. The first one is an article about Diamante Driver, who was a student in Baltimore, Maryland, who died as a result of lack of access to dental care. It was a very serious case. But increasingly, we talk to individuals in the healthcare community that say that's not necessarily an unheard of case. It simply was one of the most dramatic cases where a small child died as a result of not receiving care at an appropriate time. Immediately under that is a news release from the Kellogg Foundation about their work in expanding the dental health aid therapy program to other states beyond Alaska, and Dr. Yee will talk about that. There's also information about the first evaluation of the Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapy Program. There's also 2 pieces of information from the Pew Center on the States, which has been active in the Children's Dental Health Initiative. One is a piece about the experience in Minnesota. Last year, Minnesota passed a statute to create a new alternative dental provider, and it gives information about what that state went through in order to achieve that goal. Behind that is a brand new report that recently came out of Pew that talks about how new dental providers can benefit patients and practices. And this is the economic modeling issue in terms of how it will affect dentists in the long haul to have alternative providers in the system. To the left is an executive summary, and behind that a policy brief that was created by the Kellogg Foundation about the various opportunities for training new dental health providers in the United States. And inside of that, the first one, the executive summary, does talk about various different educational experiences, how long, what kind of hours they might have, what kind of training they might receive in order to provide these services. And then behind that is a report from the Oregon Dental Association that was completed in 2009. The dentists have created a white paper with their recommendations in terms of studying the issue. And then immediately behind that is a study that was created by the National Dental Hygienists Association that evaluated the limited access permit dental hygienist in Oregon, which is a specific kind of dental hygienist that has been authorized by this legislature over a course of many years. So we have quite a bit of information about the issue. We have quite a bit of information about how different states are trying different ways to improve access to oral health. And what we're here today to talk about are just some of those opportunities, different ways of approaching things that different states have taken. In particular, I am most familiar with, and what I've brought to you today, is the Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapy Model, which has been in place for about 5 years. And is the subject of the evaluation that was recently completed by Kellogg. So before I proceed, I wanted to see if anyone had any questions about, any of the senators have a question for me.
Proceed.
Thank you. I want to just show you a 5-minute video which explains the importance of the DHAT model and gives you a brief overview before I'm going to have Dr. Bornstein talk about it.
Meet Conan Murat. He's one of Alaska's first dental health aid therapists, or DHATs. Dental therapists like Conan can offer a safe, effective solution to filling America's unmet oral health needs.
I've had a lot of patients where, you know, they come in and they've got a lot of broken teeth or decayed teeth, and I get them back to smiling. That's always the best, when they can go out smiling and actually feel good about it, and getting someone out of pain if they've been hurting for a while. And they're just like a total relief on their face after it's over.
The fact is, 49 million children and adults in the U.S. live in areas without enough dentists. Millions more cannot afford to pay for dental care. The most advanced oral disease is found primarily among children living in poverty and some racial and ethnic minority populations. Untreated tooth decay causes infection that may lead to impaired speech development, inability to concentrate, missed opportunities for good nutrition, and decreased access to good jobs. In Aniak, Alaska, and in a dozen other rural villages, Conan Murat fills glaring dental care gaps, and to many, he is a hero.
We're so grateful that, you know, we have the therapist here, because we don't have to travel for that purpose anymore. And healthy teeth, you know, so important for my kids. You know, I just can't see how it would be without the program.
Dental therapists who complete a rigorous 2-year training program deliver desperately needed services working under a dentist's general supervision.
Well, I can provide routine exams, cleanings, multiple types of fillings, certain types of extractions. I've been doing this for 5 years now.
The DHAT model's been used in over 50 countries worldwide. It's been a proven model to be effective in many different environments. I know that it definitely works in rural Alaska.
The first major independent evaluation of U.S. dental therapists working in Alaska finds that they provide safe, competent dental care. The independent study was conducted by Research Triangle Institute. The study shows that this community-driven solution, known as the Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapist Program, can expand the reach of dentists in Alaska.
We train our students to the same level of quality that you would have students trained in dental school. So if I'm teaching somebody how to do a cavity prep, I'm using the same textbook that the dental school is using. The only difference is that they're learning fewer procedures. It's not that they're learning lesser quality.
Across the country, states are grappling with how to expand dental care access for many children and families living in underserved communities. and many are weighing the use of dental therapists.
Realize that there are a lot of people in your state who aren't receiving dental care, and this is a way where the basic dental care can be taken care of. They're still going to need dentists. It's been used all over the world, and I spent many years as a dentist working in Kathmandu, Nepal, and I've had experience of 20 years working with the DHAT, and I've seen how successful they can be and how good the quality of care can be.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, ANTHC, working in partnership with the University of Washington, began training DHATs in Alaska in 2007. America's first DHATs started training in New Zealand in 2003.
We tried everything. We tried creative recruitment strategies. We tried, you know, sending people to dental school. I mean, we did everything. And so tribal leaders across Alaska decided that, you know, it's time to do something bold and different.
Oral health is key to overall health. And with more professionally trained dental therapists working as part of a dentist-led team, fewer children and families in America will have missing teeth, live with pain, miss school or work. And more smiles will come back.
I wanted to show that particular one because it most recently was produced to talk about how this model could be expanded beyond the Tribal Health Consortium. And while it was designed specifically and created in Alaska to address the needs of the tribal communities in remote villages, the model itself can be expanded and used in other areas. And it's proven to be used in 50 different countries around the world. It's important to think about the fact that while it would be ideal, I think, to have more dentists and to have access for every single person to have a dental home and to have a dentist to care for them, it's fairly unrealistic to think that we're going to accomplish that. The number of dentists that are being trained, the number of dentists that are distributed across the country, particularly in rural and outside of urban areas, is pretty consistent with probably the way primary care is delivered in this country. And I think that being able to look at different models of oral health services that might provide basic services and in a way that is as close as possible as we can to an actual dentist is what we're suggesting that you think about. And we're not suggesting any particular model. The Northwest Health Foundation is not wed to a particular model. What we are encouraging is that you take a look at a variety of different opportunities to try and increase access for people in this state. And so I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Bornstein, and he can talk about their experience in Alaska.
Thank you. One of the reasons I went to dental school was I assumed I would never have to talk to more than one person at a time.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Tom Bornstein. I'm the Director of Dental Services for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, and I live in Juneau, Alaska. And give you a little bit of background on our program, and I'll try and sort of make our experience relevant to your situation, give you a little bit of context as to why we made some of the decisions surrounding mid-level, lower-level care. Within our system, we provide care for Alaska Natives, American Indians. We have also some FQHCs and provide some care to homeless folks in Juneau, Alaska through a HRSA grant. And so within that system, we provide dental services to all of those folks. If you provide private practice dental care, and most of the dentistry done in the U.S. is through private practice, and you wake up in the morning, you go to your office, and there's a line around the block, you say, business is good. If I wake up in the morning and go to my public practice, and there's a line around the block, I don't really have a choice but to try and improve access to care. And there's the difference, and I think you're in the business of trying to ameliorate the situation for public care. And so in that way, we kind of share this same issue of access to care. And we're talking about basic care at this point, where, you know, if you kind of wake up and look in the mirror and you decide that your teeth could be just a shade whiter, you've got too much time on your hands. You know, we're talking about folks that obviously are going without some basic care that leads to infections, abscesses, pain, things like that. So in the U.S., access to care for the uninsured and underinsured is really the issue. If you have great insurance or if you have lots of money, there is no issue. You can get dental care. And if you live in a metropolitan area, typically you can get good care. If you don't have good insurance, you don't have funds, and you live in a more rural community or in an underserved area, you really don't have great access to dental services. This is the problem that we faced several years ago. We started kind of with a blank slate to try and address the access to care issue. And so we developed a workforce model that we felt was going to meet our needs. And I'd kind of like to put into context for you a little bit of what we were thinking at the time and why we reached some of the decisions that we did. And I'm going to take you on just a small digression here at first. And I know it's mentioned as part of my bio, after dental school I worked for a little bit, and then I did a two-year residency at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. It's called an advanced general practice residency. And during that residency, you do rotations through many of the hospital services. And one of my rotations was through general surgery, and I had the opportunity to scrub in on some cases that were being done by some of the thoracic surgeons. And these surgeons were older, mostly retired at the time, the ones that I'm speaking of, but they had come back and they were volunteering their time. And I got the opportunity to, in between cases, to talk to some of them. And these were among the most dedicated, most sincere, hardworking individuals I've ever met. And they got their experience as TB surgeons. Many of the hospitals in Alaska in the generation prior to me getting there were TB hospitals, and tuberculosis was just the scourge of Alaska Natives. And I talked to the surgeons, and they spent countless hours doing chest surgery. They became some of the finest thoracic surgeons in the U.S. because of experience. The spread of TB in Alaska was pretty much at epidemic proportion at the time. And this is kind of what I took away from that from talking to them and listening and realizing that TB is not the scourge of Alaska at this moment. And thought about what turned the tide. And it wasn't the quality of the surgeons, it wasn't the dedication of the surgeons, and I would say they are the highest quality and most dedicated folks that I have ever worked with. What turned the tide? Who cured TB? Why aren't there more sanitarians in Alaska now? It was a medical cure. It was the nurses on the floor. It was the public health nurses. It was the direct observers, local, closer to home, observing that people got their medication, that they took it, that they knew how to take it. The Mycobacterium tuberculosis didn't care what the level of training of the surgeons was. It didn't care how dedicated they were. What it cared was that there was a medication that would impact the bacterium. And so I want to kind of draw a little parallel between that and to dentistry, and sort of why I am in favor of the mid-levels in dental practice. And first of all, I want to do just a sort of a brief statement about the difference between the medical model and the surgical model of care. And as I already mentioned, the surgical model it involves excising the offending bit of whatever it is, and then if you cut off something important, you try to replace it, whether it's a leg or a tooth or an arm or a breast. You try to fashion something prosthetically to fix it or make it look better. Medical model addresses the underlying issue in either bacterial or viral or fungal disease. And tooth decay, which is a really good example of how this model works, for 4,000 years up until now, has been treated by the surgical model. Now, it turns out that tooth decay is a transmissible bacterial infection. That's all it is. And I want to walk you through the gold standard of care. If you or somebody you cared a lot about had kind of a mouthful of cavities, had dental infections, caries, basically you'd want the decay removed. You'd want a filling material placed in there. You'd want sealants to prevent other areas from becoming decayed. And you would take up to kill the bacteria using rinses, antimicrobial rinses. And you would try and make the tooth surfaces remain more resistant to decay using fluoride varnishes. You would check the bacterial level that the patients have. So you would do a bioassay to check and see what their bacterial load is. You'd check the pH of their saliva, see if they have an acidic environment for the bacteria to work in. You'd push xylitol products for them and have them used appropriately. You'd give them oral hygiene instructions in a language they can understand in a culturally appropriate and sensitive way. And that's really the gold standard of treatment for a lot of what's wrong with teeth. And there's not anything on this list that can't be done by a mid-level practitioner. That's basic dental care. Now, anything more advanced than that calls for advanced training. Dentists have advanced training. And there's been, at no time ever did we suggest independent practice of dental therapists without a collaborative dentist involved in the care. So I think that sometimes the mid-level has been the model has been a little bit distorted, but they really require a collaborative dentist. Now, as I said, everything on that list that I just described as the gold standard of care can be accomplished by a mid-level, but it can be accomplished by a mid-level under general supervision. It can be care that's delivered closer to home by people in jobs closer to home. You don't need to drive 5 hours to have somebody paint fluoride varnish on your teeth. You don't need to drive 5 hours for somebody to sit down and explain just sort of what I've explained to you about the bacterial infection and how you need certain things done. What you need is somebody closer to home who's actually willing to provide those services. You know, and I go to villages as part of my work, and I know that I can talk to the receptionist, or in many cases we have dental health aides out there. They know the community. They know where to find the kids. They know who they're staying with now. They know the people that are sick and infirmed and how to get to them. They visit the senior center. I mean, these are, and they provide preventive services. They provide a reasonable alternative to traveling for advanced care. As I said, we started with a blank slate and tried to come up with a design for a workforce model that would work. And so we looked at various levels that exist out there or existed in what we came up with was a tiered system of dental health aides and expanded function dental assistants and dental health aide therapists. The one that's garnered the most attention is the dental health aide therapists for various reasons. The primary dental health aides are folks that can apply varnishes and do rinses and do oral hygiene instruction. And the next level of primary dental health aid, they can provide sealants and they can take x-rays, they can do simple cleanings and all of the things that the first level of primary dental health aid can do. The expanded function dental assistant can provide, can place filling material, though not remove any tooth structure. The DHAT, the dental health aid therapist, can actually do a filling start to finish. So they can provide anesthetic and they can do routine fillings. They can do stainless steel crowns for baby teeth. They can do simple extractions, and in, on a practical basis, they consult us before they do any extraction. But and we ensure that they are routine extractions, so they're not doing complicated surgery or even complicated extractions. As I say, all of the above need a collaborative dentist to supervise them. And then, of course, the dentist takes over where the scope of service of the others leave off, and so the dentist can do root canals, prosthodontics like crowns, bridges. They can do limited orthodontics, surgeries, dentures, and have a strong, should have a strong basis in oral pathology, and so they can do routine biopsies and sort of identify problems that are beyond the scope of what these other workers can do. The level of training required for these various kinds of services, with the primary dental health aides, they can go through a basically a week and a half long course, and then they have a prescribed number of preceptored cases that they need to do under observation, and they're really providing very limited non-invasive care. They're working with a tiny paintbrush to paint fluoride varnishes on. They're, you know, doing rinses. They're basically following the directions of the dentist as to what's been prescribed through the treatment plan. And the next level up, they need another week and a half of training. Most of them, the next level would be the primary dental health aid level two. They need a little bit more training. Many of them come from a dental assisting background. They know how to take dental x-rays. They can, they've learned how to do sealants. They can do a little bit more level of care. And I should point out that the primary dental health aid level two is essentially the same health force worker as the American Dental Association has endorsed, and they're trying to develop that model right now. They have I believe they call it their community oral health provider or something like that. And so the American Dental Association, even though they're a little late to the game for the dental health aid level two, that's what they're creating, and they support that. The expanded function dental assistant, we modeled after, and the first two levels we modeled after the existing community health aid program in Alaska. And so the CHAPS had for many years provided medical care in Alaska. In fact, they used to do radio call, and they'd call in to the hospitals, and they would, you know, report what they saw. And so they had a basic level of training where they could provide basic care at the direction of physicians. And that's really kind of the model we looked at for developing that level. The expanded function dental assistant, many states had been using it. The military used dental techs, and essentially the same thing. They could place filling material. The Indian Health Service had an expanded function dental assistant training program, and so many of the of those guys were in existence when we looked at that model. And then lastly, we looked at the dental health aid therapist model, and the dental health aid therapist were existent, as mentioned, in many countries. Primarily, we were intrigued by the New Zealand model, which was one of the oldest and most well-established. And so that was the model that we based our original planning on. So Why will the situation probably not change for you unless some action's taken? You know, the dentist, and I am a dentist, and I have lots of respect for the profession, as well as practicing on the surgical model and being trained in the surgical model, they also operate on the business model. And so they essentially need to fund their own education. They need to fund, they often graduate with a fairly prohibitive debt for their education. They need to provide startup costs for their business that they run. It can run $750,000 to establish a practice and lease a space and all of those things. And essentially, and provide overhead to, essentially, they need to locate their business where their business will be sustainable and in light of the expenses. The mid-levels are less expensive to train. Their salaries are not as high. They can be further from home. Many of them have ties to smaller communities. And in the situation, which is why I kind of also don't think the situation will change drastically unless something different is infused into the situation, is that if a dentist practice is going well, why change things? And if it's not going well, then they're not going to move further from a paying customer base. They're going to move closer to a paying customer base. And so I think that's kind of further distances the uninsured and underinsured from care. So I think I'll conclude my remarks there, but I appreciate your attention, and I'd be certainly willing to answer any questions that I can.
Just a couple. Where are your dental therapists trained?
On our staff, we have three. One of them was trained in New Zealand, and two of them were trained in Alaska. We have a training program in Alaska that they spend their first year in Anchorage and primarily get their didactic training. Their second year they spend in Bethel, Alaska, which is a very rural community and no shortage of patient care needed there. And then after that, they go back to the hub site. They have a predetermined job before they start the programs, so they have to have a collaborative agreement with a tribal organization. They go back to the hub site, and they have to do a mandatory 400-hour preceptorship at the hub site before they're signed off on by the community health aid board. And I would say that also that they get federal certification to practice as a dental health aid therapist. They're not state licensed, and so that's.
And I just want to say that's because these are federal Indian tribal lands, and that's why they're federally certified. In other states, that's obviously a difference. Would be here in Oregon, we would have a state licensing, but that's been the unique situation for Alaska has been simply that they're working with the tribes and with the federal government rather than with the state legislature on this project.
That's why it was easier to get through.
I'm not sure I would agree that it was easy. And in fact, it was quite controversial, but I think that the response, because it comes from the tribal organizations, and each of the DHATs has a relationship with the tribal organization that hires them, and every dentist that supervises that group or number of people has their own model of working. So Dr. Bornstein does a lot of, goes out and will do assessments and then will assign a dental health aid therapist to complete the work. Some dentists do the opposite, where they have the therapist go out and do the initial assessment, make some screenings, make some determination, and do referrals. So it really depends on the dentist's supervision to decide how that might actually get implemented, with the understanding that those therapists are constantly in contact with their supervisor.
And Madam Chair, I would add that as far as supervision goes, within the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, We have about 15 dentists on staff that work with us throughout the year, and we have probably another 20 contract dentists. No dentist has ever lost their job because of the working, because they've been replaced by a dental health aide therapist. And none of the dentists that I work with have an issue with supervising the dental health aide therapist. So.
And how many dental therapists are in the state of Alaska, and how many dentists are participating in this? Did you say 15?
There's 15 that just work for the Southeast Alaska Regional Consortium. Yeah, statewide. Within Alaska, the tribal health care is divided up into regional consortiums, basically. So there's quite a number of regional health consortiums, and most of the larger ones are using dental health aid therapists. So they're using them in the Norton Sound Health Corporation, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation.
Are you talking hundreds or...
No. With how many practicing DHATs are there? There's probably about a dozen right now.
Okay.
And it's still in its fairly, early stages, and so we're trying not to train more than we need and less than we need, and we could certainly soak up another probably several dozen with no trouble at all.
Thank you.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you and thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to talk about the dental therapy program. excuse me. Again, my name is Al Yee. I'm a senior project director at the Education Development Center. In that role, I'm actually consulting to the Kellogg Foundation as well. And prior to joining EDC, I was actually a program director at the Kellogg Foundation and was very involved with the initiation and the development of the dental therapy work at the Kellogg Foundation. I've been continuously involved with it at the foundation since I left. So I feel that I'm in a good position to give you a little bit about the Kellogg's perspective. Dr. Bornstein gave you the on-the-ground perspective. I'm going to give you the foundation perspective, at least one foundation's perspective. Just very briefly about the Kellogg Foundation. The main mission of the Kellogg Foundation is really to improve the lives of young children. And they support the growth and development of children, especially children from vulnerable families and from underserved communities. And one of their major program priorities is really health and well-being. So in that context, the Kellogg Foundation has supported a lot of work to improve access to health overall, and has supported a lot of work over the years in oral health as well. But more recently, it's really had the opportunity to really dive deeply into this particular topic of dental therapy. Now, we've mentioned DHATs, dental health aid therapists. I should be clear. When I say dental therapists, I'm referring to the DHAT or dental health aid therapist model in Alaska. So please be aware it's interchangeable. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit how the Kellogg Foundation got involved in this project and some evaluation work that we've done and basically what we're now learning from the evaluation and some other studies that we've been able to support. But how did we get involved in the dental therapy project in Alaska? Basically, about 5-plus years ago, I was sitting at my desk and we received a proposal from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and they really wanted to start a training program in Alaska for dental therapy. And I said, what is dental therapy? I really had no idea what dental therapy was at that time. What I came to learn was that because of the severe oral health needs in the tribal community up in Alaska, Dr. Bornstein and others and leaders in that community basically, as the video alluded to, tried everything they could to try to address the oral health needs and were not able to do so. And they discovered this dental therapy model, which actually originated in New Zealand almost a century ago. And what they started to do was recruit young people from Alaska and sent them over to New Zealand to be trained to come back as dental therapists to practice in their communities. So we received this proposal because the tribal community in Alaska felt that New Zealand was sort of far away, and they wanted to develop their own training program on American soil. And they developed a curriculum together with the University of Washington, sent us a proposal and said, Kellogg, could you please fund this? And so again, for us, it was a brand new topic for us. None of us really knew what that was all about. And frankly, we were a little skeptical about certain aspects of the proposal. And the skepticism really came, had to do with the restorative procedures, the drilling and the filling and the extractions. You know, many of us, some of us grew up in the healthcare world, and we know that, you know, generally dentists have at least 8 years of training after high school in order to perform those procedures as well as other procedures. What they were proposing was that individuals with 2 years of training after high school will be doing some of these restorative procedures, and we were quite concerned about the quality of care that they were providing. So we were, again, a little skeptical. I don't know if we told Tom that right then, but so we had to go through our own due diligence and review of this particular proposal and see whether this was worth Kellogg getting involved. Basically, the long and short of it, and some of it came up in the video, what we learned in terms of our own research was that, number one, this model, again, began about a century ago in New Zealand, so the model is not new. And over the decade, it's now established in over 50 other countries. It's actually the norm and the standard as part of the workforce model, providing care to patients in the population in 50 other countries, including many advanced healthcare systems. And most importantly, we were able to find certain studies that showed that dental therapists in these other countries were able to provide good, solid, quality care within their scope of practice. And for us, that was a bit of an epiphany. What we learned was that dental therapists basically performed a limited number of procedures. And they were trained to, again, I'm talking about just the controversial pieces about the restorative care, to do a lot of prevention and the medical approach as well. But they were trained to do these limited number of procedures, and they performed them over and over and over again. So they became quite proficient. That was our epiphany. And that we realized that with the severe needs of the Alaska Native tribal communities in Alaska in terms of severe oral health status, that they tried everything else to try to address those needs over decades and really were swimming upstream. And we became comfortable that this was a worthwhile model to support. So that was our journey in terms of eventually funding that particular training program, which is now training its fourth cohort of students. And to get to your question a little bit more, Madam Chair, I think initially 10 students returned from New Zealand to practice in Alaska, and by the time our fourth cohort together with other funders are finished training, we will have more than tripled the number of dental therapists practicing in Alaska. I think it's going to be about 33 or 34 by the time that the program is, our program is finished funding. So that's really how we got involved in the dental therapy program, but we really looked at that initiation about 4 or 5 years ago as the beginning of some additional learning. So since then, we've actually funded a number of studies and reports, initially for our own learning about dental therapy, but also really to share that more broadly so people can understand, or at least those that are interested, learn more about these alternative dental providers and mid-levels. And one of the studies that we did support was an evaluation project, an evaluation of the dental health aid therapist program in Alaska. I'm not talking about the training program that we had just funded at that time, but we thought it was important to also do an implementation evaluation of the New Zealand dental therapists that came back, were already in practice. So we want to do an evaluation of the program so that the tribes will have the data, the information about how well the program is doing, and also information about where the areas of improvement might be. And it took about 2 years to do that study, and there were two advisory committees, one local, one national, to help advise and provide input and feedback on the actual study. And basically what we found, and I guess two key findings came out of that study, and in fact, we just released a report 2 months ago, and I think there's a summary in the packet that you received. It basically demonstrated that the dental therapists in Alaska that were studied performed safe, competent, and appropriate care. And it, what it did was, well, I'll get to that point in a second. The other thing that it showed was that the residents and the patients were highly satisfied with the care they were receiving from the dental therapist. But I guess the most important thing about this study is that it reaffirmed many other studies that I referred to earlier from other countries that show that dental therapists provide safe, quality care, and as well as some recent studies. And also, what I neglected to mention, when we got into this work, we again realized that there were studies that showed they provide good quality care, and we were looking for and asked if anybody knew of any studies that showed the contrary, that they were unsafe or they did not provide unsafe care. And basically, over the last 5 or 6 years, we still have not found any studies that have contrary findings. That was one study that we did. We've also funded some other studies, and in the interest of time, I won't get into any detail, but we funded some studies to basically provide information about oral health needs and access needs in this country, but also, especially early on when we were not wedded to a particular model because we were still learning, we funded a report that looked at all the different models, the mid-level models being considered, and that included but that was not limited to the dental therapist model. And then I think an important study, and I think the summary again is in the report, in the packet that you received, we funded some work that examined pretty comprehensively at training and curricula for dental therapy. And again, that study is summarized in one of the packets that you received. And what we continue to try to learn, and with other funders and other organizations, funding some other studies along the way. And the reason I'm bringing all this up is that I think there's a lot more information out there now than there was 5 years ago when we got involved in it. So I would encourage people that are interested to get some of this information and learn firsthand, you know, what's going on with the dental therapy and basically the mid-level agenda. And I guess most interestingly, a report just came out, was released about 2 weeks ago by the General Accounting Office of the Federal Government. And if I can remember the title of the report, they looked at efforts to improve children's access to dental services. And so it was a pretty comprehensive report, but there was one section that really looked at dental therapy. And what they did was they looked at dental therapy programs in a number of other countries, established programs. And what they reported was that these other programs, again, demonstrated that it's good quality care and some good outcomes. And again, that just came out 2 weeks ago. So there's more and more information available for those that are interested. So with this experience in Alaska and the learning from the various reports and studies, and actually I should also say we were involved in some work in Minnesota as well a little over a year ago. And for those of you that may not know, Minnesota actually passed legislation about a year or so ago that allows for dental therapists to be trained in Minnesota and to practice in Minnesota. And so we were involved in the state there and our work with Alaska and all this learning over the last 3 or 4 years. We decided about a year or so ago to sort of take a different approach to raising the awareness about dental therapy. And this took the form of actually collaborating with some partners in some key states that are interested in actually adopting the dental therapy model as an approach to improving access to care for underserved populations. So what's going on in these particular states are partnerships and coalitions that have formed, and their role will be to basically provide as much information as they can and education to people that are interested in this particular model, to various stakeholders, decision makers, and policy makers. And the states that we're partnering with in terms of the partnerships in those states are Washington State, Kansas, New Mexico, Ohio, and Vermont. And we know that there's some other states involved. I think Pew was mentioned a little while ago. They're involved in a number of other states. So I just want to let you know that there's some efforts going on in different states looking at mid-level models, alternative dental models, and dental therapy. I guess in the interest of time, the few additional points I just want to mention very briefly. There are certain perspectives that we have from our learning, being involved with this opportunity the last several years that really guide our work in the states. I think number one, we believe very firmly that the quality of care provided by dental therapists is good quality care and it's safe. You know, until someone provides a study that tells us otherwise, you know, that's what the evidence is out there that's showing. It's presently a two-tiered care in this system right now. Those that have access to care and those that do not. And we believe that dental therapists should be part of the conversation when people are thinking about long-term solutions to improve access to underserved populations. Secondly, we believe that the length of training ideally should be 2 years for dental therapists. And the reason we believe it should be 2 years is because the studies that have shown the good quality care were basically studies of dental therapists that were trained for 2 years. So I don't think there's a need necessarily to have more years of training for dental therapists. And I think the other very important thing that sometimes gets lost in the conversation is that, and I think Dr. Bornstein mentioned it, is the cost of training. If 2 years is been shown to be the right level of training, it basically makes it easier for people, especially people from poor and underserved communities. It's less costly and might be more attractive for them to want to enter this profession. Also, the debt burden will be less. So it'll be more likely that they'll go back to the communities to work in underserved communities and provide the culturally competent care that we all think is important. And then I think the general supervision piece, in the interest of time, I won't mention it, but that's just another perspective that we think is important. And Dr. Bornstein went into some detail, but we just think that that's really the right approach to have dental therapists practicing in areas where there are no dentists or not enough dentists in order to truly affect access to care. And I guess the last thing I want to say is that, you know, the Kellogg Foundation sort of been accused of being sort of a one-trick pony, really sort of pushing this one agenda for the last few years around oral health, and we have. But I just want to be clear to people that we, you know, and from a personal standpoint, you know, the last 30, 40 years of my health career, I've been working on issues around improving access to underserved populations for in general health, not just oral health. And we all know that trying to improve access to care for underserved populations is highly, highly complex. And it will take multifaceted, multi-pronged solutions and long-term solutions to try to address this issue. That being said, we believe that dental therapy is a promising opportunity based on our experience, based on the evidence, and based on what we've learned from other countries. And again, we just believe it should be part of the conversation when people are thinking about long-term solutions to improve the health of underserved populations. Thank you.
Tell me again, a student applies, and where do they apply? I mean, how do you get the applicant, and then do they actually go to University of Washington to get trained? Or are they...
I think I can answer that, Madam Chair. But at present, because it's limited to the tribal organizations, the tribes, I think, nominate someone to be in the program, and then they're screened and they're accepted into the program. They have a job waiting for them when they finish. The training takes place in Anchorage for the first year and second year in Bethel, Alaska, which is a remote village, which I think Dr. Bates has actually been to, and Senator Morse as well. And I think that...
I didn't go for dental care.
You didn't go for dental care. But I think that... that's just a very recent incantation of the training program that's taken place. The original DHATs were trained in New Zealand for 2 years. The desire to create a training program in state, clearly there's some advantages to doing that. And every state that's looking at this as a model is going to have to look at how are these folks going to be trained, where are they going to be trained, what will be the procedure. There has been discussion for quite some time amongst a number of folks on the national level that community colleges could be, programs could be created within community colleges in partnership with dental schools to create this kind of model in local communities. You know from our experience in working in nursing that creating programs out in rural areas so that people don't have to be trained to come into the city to be trained is a way to keep them in their home community. Clearly, that's an important aspect of community college training. And I just wanted to end our presentation and, of course, answer any questions, but I wanted to let you know that there are a significant number of private funders in this state who have been looking at this issue for the last year. And we, as a group, have been looking at what are the needs, the oral health needs of the citizens of Oregon. Where are the leverage points that private funding can support? What are the areas that we might be looking at? And one of the issues that the private funders have gathered around has been this idea of potentially creating new workforce models that could then be implemented to benefit the state. So there is interest in the private funding, and additionally there are federal funds through the Accountable Care Act that may become available with regards to pilot projects around mid-level providers that I wanted to alert the committee to as well.
Great.
And then if anyone has any questions, of course.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question. What percentage of a general dentistry practice could be performed by a dental therapist?
It depends on what level of care that you're talking about. The scope of services for the dental health aid therapist is limited to routine fillings, stainless steel crowns for kids, simple extractions, and that's really their scope of service. If your practice is fairly high in crown and bridge and implants and root canals, very little would be applicable. If you are providing basic oral health care in a smaller community where a large part of your practice is preventive services, fillings, routine care, then probably 70%.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, I've enjoyed the... Yes.
No, thank you, Chair. Really a two-part question. You mentioned that adult therapy sometimes requires a consult with a dentist. In Alaska, can that be? Does that have to be on-site? Can it be telehealth? And then secondly, is there a ratio of the number of dentists to therapists that has to be in place, similar to what PAs are here?
Yeah. There's no ratio prescribed of dentist to therapist. And your first question?
Well, just how the consult takes place.
Yeah,
can that be on-site?
Yeah,
can be telephone?
Yeah. We have electronic dental records, and they basically either as part of the electronic record take an x-ray and we view it, or they email us an x-ray. In some places, they actually have to physically take a film x-ray, take a picture of it, and then email it to us. But yeah, we get a visual on for any of the consults that they, you know, that are deemed appropriate that we would require them to consult us with.
But I think the question is, do they have to be on site? And I think
it's general supervision, so we can phone consult them and through the electronic record consult them.
Yes.
That's a quick question. Thank you. Interesting conversation. Thanks for coming down here. Two questions. One is, do your dental care providers work with people who are non-tribal and who have no health insurance or dental insurance? One of the biggest barriers here in Oregon is really lack of dental insurance. Our Medicaid programs are pretty solid. I think they probably take care of the greater proportion of needs of people referred to them, but we have a large segment of the population that doesn't have dental insurance, and a lot of our kids. Mm-hmm. So do you take care of people outside of your program? And that's the first question. The second question is, have you had a conversation with our what we call our DCOs, or dental care organizations here in the state? Have you had that conversation at all? So two different questions.
I haven't had any conversations with anybody here.
Okay.
And in order to receive care through a tribal health organization, you have to be a beneficiary of that system in some capacity, whether it means you're an Alaska Native American Indian or you qualify for services in one of our FQHCs, then you can receive the services that we have available. So in that regard, we are providing some dental health aid therapist care to folks that are non-tribal members, but they're all folks who are beneficiary of the tribal system.
I answer the question. They got the same barriers we do, then, that if you haven't got health insurance or dental insurance, I should say, you're probably still locked out of the system, so it's difficult. Yeah. The other question was, have you had a chance to talk to our DCOs about this type of service, and what's the response to it?
Yeah, this is just beginning that discussion, I think. This is a controversial subject, as the Madam Chair alluded to. The interest on the part of discussing alternatives to provide care and access, particularly for the uninsured, clearly we have a huge number of people who don't have any insurance for dental care, who are underemployed or unemployed, who don't qualify for Medicaid. And then in addition, quite frankly, the Medicaid population isn't being well served in dental care. There's a number of particularly eligible children under SCHIP who have coverage but don't necessarily have access to care because either there's not a dentist locally that's available to them or they can't get an appointment because there's too many of them. There's a lot of reasons that might prohibit even a covered child from receiving services in the dental community. So beyond just those that don't have coverage, even those under the Medicaid system may not actually have true access to care. So for us, it's a double question there. And in terms of what might become available through those discussions, I think that's a broader discussion in terms of the dental care organizations and how they might work with us on this issue in providing services and more access.
Just to let you know, there is a process going on right now with the Dental Association and it's a scope of practice issue, obviously, and then those who are in favor of dental therapists. So I think they've had a couple of meetings now. Through the grapevine, I hear those aren't going well. But I just want you to know, if they can't come out with a product, maybe we just have to go ahead and come up with our own product.
I always appreciate testimony. I would want to hear from ZCOs about what you've said about kids not being able to get in, because that's not been my experience in Medford. We get pretty prompt responses, even to difficult cases, which have general anesthetic sometimes to be taken care of. So that's not been the experience in my area. If it's someplace else, I'd sure like to hear about it. But I want to hear that from the DCOs themselves, too. That's a very interesting topic if the DCOs are not getting a job that we think they are. I have not heard that before.
And Senator Bates, I would love to have those conversations with the DCOs about what access is available and where services are being provided and where they're not. We've heard reports to the contrary, and not necessarily in Medford, in your area, but I think that the issue in terms of as much access as possible and coverage, I mean, if we can't cover everyone, but at least we could provide services at a lower cost, then at least we have the services available for those that don't fall under that Medicaid coverage. So I would welcome any kind of conversation with the dental care organizations as well as the ODS and the ODA in that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so very much. And if our concept, whichever product comes out, I would love to have you come and speak again, probably to the House side, if we can get it through the Senate side.
Thank you.
Or we'll show them the tape of this. But thank you
thank
very,
you
very
so much.
Thank you so much.
With that, I would like to move on to protecting kids from tobacco use, the relationship of an increase in youth hookah smoking and exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act. And Katrina Hedberg.
Here's a...
He's going to give us a demonstration.
I'll be right back. And I won't fall asleep. I gotta get a cup of coffee.
Wow.
It's 4:30. I'm getting drowsy.
It's interesting.
That'll wake her up.
Jeez. Don't go
there. Jeez.
I've never seen something like that.
I've heard about these things. This is real popular in the Middle East, but there's these.
While they're getting ready, I want the committee to know that I had introduced legislation last session, or I think the 2009 session, I can't remember which session, regarding hookah, and it didn't get out of committee. Now, since these hookah bars are proliferating, I think we'll find it very interesting, the report that public health has come up with on the increase of smoking among our youth.
I think they borrowed that from the Oregon Country Fair in Van County. So is Katie King going to try that out?
Can you?
Sure.
I'm sorry. All of these are different.
The mouse is made up.
All right. How do I make it a big slideshow? I use this all the time. It's just every version is different. That's what I was trying to do from the beginning. All right. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Authority, and it's my pleasure to be here to talk to you today about the issue of hookah smoking and some exemptions to the Indoor Clean Air Act. So just brief overview, tobacco continues to be the leading cause, preventable cause of death in Oregon. Tobacco smoke is related to 7,000 deaths each year, including 800 deaths related to exposure to secondhand smoke. And most people who are current smokers or start smoking don't do so as an adult. They don't wake up at age 50 and start smoking, but rather they are trying tobacco products as as teens and young adults and then pick up a lifetime habit. And so a third of the teens who try cigarette smoking prior to when they're teens, before leaving high school, a third of them become regular smokers, and a third of those will end up dying prematurely from a smoking-related illness. So actually in Oregon, since the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program got initially funded back in 1996, we've seen a decline in the prevalence both of adult tobacco use from around 25%, and it's currently around 17%. And we've seen a similar decline in cigarette smoking among youth. And so this slide here shows the top, the U.S., has seen a decline, but the bottom line, the lower one there in the lighter blue, is Oregon. And so actually the prevalence of smoking in teens in Oregon is lower than that in the United States. Of some concern, you can see it's been declining steadily. It appears to be leveling off very slightly here in recent, in the last couple of years. So this brings the issue at hand. This graph shows tobacco use by the type of tobacco that's used. The top line is 11th graders who report cigarette use, and this is cigarette use in the past 30 days. And the line, second line, middle one there is hookah use by 11th graders, and then the bottom light line is smokeless tobacco use. So what this shows is that between 2008 and 2009, tobacco use, both cigarette as well as smokeless tobacco, declined among 11th graders, and the one area that saw increased use was in the use of hookah. So what is hookah? I do have a demonstration here. Hookah, and what people smoke in hookah is tobacco, although it has a different name. It's called shisha, is the name of the tobacco, and I'll get to a little bit in a minute. But shisha, and I think we're going to pass a sample of it around so that you all can get kind of a feel for what it looks like and smells like. Shisha itself is a tobacco that it's not burning by itself because it has been soaked in things like honey and other products. It has flavoring. It's a very thick, sticky tobacco. And so the way it gets smoked is that you have a bowl at the top here, and actually there's a piece of charcoal that gets put on, and the charcoal is what heats the tobacco and causes it, because it won't continue to burn just by itself. Then the base is at the very bottom, and that includes, it's partially filled with water, so these are also called water pipes. And then the stem obviously connects the bowl to the base, as you can see here. And then the hoses, and the one that I brought here has two hoses, so this is often a communal way of smoking tobacco. But when people inhale through the hoses, obviously the smoke then goes through the base and the water, which does a couple of things. Again, this is a tobacco product which has flavoring, so it doesn't taste as harsh as regular tobacco, and because it's inhaled through the water bath, if you will, it's cooler and less harsh than tobacco products or other types of tobacco. So that leads a lot of people to think that this is perhaps safer than other types of tobacco. But it isn't. It's still tobacco, and it hookah delivers nicotine, which of course is an addictive drug. In addition, because of the setting, hookah users often inhale very large volumes of smoke, as much as 100 cigarettes in a session. That would be an evening at a hookah lounge or at a hookah house party. And of course, smoking hookah, you get the same diseases that are caused by cigarette smoking. Now, it hasn't been, if you will, as common a practice here in Oregon recently, although we've seen this increase both in Oregon as well as in other parts of the United States, but there are a lot of data from other countries of the world, the Middle East, where this has been a much longer tradition, as well as other parts that really do show that that hookah puts people at risk for other tobacco-related diseases. So here's a list of the flavorings. You can see they have a variety of exotic kind of names, anything, Starbuzz flavors here, but exotic citrus, mint, and apple. There are a variety of fruit flavors, candy flavors. A number of these are also, you have margarita down at the bottom, so alcohol type flavorings as well.
Now,
it turns out that, so it is tobacco mixed with syrup and flavoring, and flavored tobacco is banned for cigarettes, in part because flavored tobaccos do, they appeal to use flavored tobaccos, and so it has been banned for cigarettes, but not for use smoking and hookah. So the Indoor Clean Air Act was implemented in January of 2009, which prohibited smoking indoor workplaces and other public places, but there were a couple of exceptions to this. Cigar bars and smoke shops can be certified to allow indoor smoking, and cigar bars had to be in existence prior to the law going in effect, so if you will, those were grandfathered in, but the smoke shops can be certified. Now, smoke shops, I think the original intention for smoke shops was a place where people could sample higher-end tobacco products that they would then take off-site, if you will. But many of these hookah lounges are seeking to open a business to allow smoking indoors under the smoke shop exemption. So this shows some of the predictors of having youth initiate tobacco use. And then we did do interviews of youth and parents, actually, as part of focus groups to find out what their impressions were of tobacco use.
While we're on the topic, what about indoor or secondhand smoke?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I will talk a little bit about the secondhand smoke because within these hookah lounges, I have a slide on it, high levels of secondhand smoke. So, again, some of the predictors of youth tobacco use really are reflected completely in what happens with hookah use. So, perceptions of smoking among peer, obviously, if peers are smoking, youth is more likely to have uptake of it. And hookah use is perceived to be relatively common. I have a teenage son, actually, he's a senior in high school. And when I asked him, he, of course, hasn't tried hookah, but he, you know, it's well known in high schools in Portland about hookah use. Whether your friends smoke, and, you know, hookah, again, is a social activity, and it can have several of these hoses that come off, so it is much more of a social activity than perhaps cigarette smoking, even. A perception of low risk, and hookah isn't seen as harmful, again, because the smoke itself feels a lot less harsh, and I had talked a little bit about flavored tobacco. In addition, it has this name, shisha, which makes it sound like it's herb or exotic or whatever, but it really is, it is just tobacco. So a couple of photos of what's happening. This is a hookah lounge and with kind of a bar club atmosphere. There are also house parties, and if you look at these pictures, you can see pretty young kids are doing this kind of activity in homes. And then here is an more intimate hookah lounge where people are sitting around and smoking these hookah pipes. Obviously, the intention here is not just to sample and then take it elsewhere, but they're really spending a number of hours here. So the issue of secondhand smoke, we did, as part of looking at compliance with the Indoor Clean Air Act, we went around to some hookah lounges and did some air monitoring. And what you can see is that the hookah lounges, the category is from unhealthy at the bottom, and these are rated by the Environmental Protection Agency. So an unhealthy category, everyone may begin to experience some health effects and sensitive groups, people with asthma and those kinds of things more. Very unhealthy. The middle bar there, a health alert, everyone may experience the serious effects. And of the hookah lounges we looked at, 5 in Oregon were in this category, and then 1 was at the top level, hazardous, were health warnings of emergency conditions. So very high particulate matters, both of smoke as well as all of the other things that are contained in cigarette smoke or tobacco smoke. And again, we have copies of the Indoor Clean Air Act, the full report for the committee as well.
I visited the hookah lounge that is in my community in Rockwood, and I was talking with the owner, and all of a sudden I started coughing, and I said, can we continue this conversation outside? I really wanted to understand. There was only 5 people in the lounge, but obviously I couldn't see the smoke, but obviously I couldn't. I was having coughing fits, so
that was kind of my question. Is it visible smoke, or just is it the
sometimes?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Morris said, it is regular smoke, and this is coming off. But depending on how many users there are, and again, there are people who are more sensitive to smoke. You can certainly smell it, et cetera.
Yeah.
But yes, I think I'm trying to see whether or not our picture's there, especially the one on the left here, sort of a hazier environment. I guess these others you don't see quite so clearly. But particularly that hookah lounge with the very hazardous condition, there is smoke that is visible in these places, much as when you see, smoking in a bar that used to be in a bar before our Indoor Clean Air Act, you'd be able to see smoke. So hookah lounges really do target younger customers. The majority are under the age of 75. 25. Excuse me. As I get older, young seems to be getting older as well. Anyway, so this is a quote. And one of the things we have been looking at are these hookah lounges do advertise on social media like Facebook. Their Facebook pages, again, a number of these are in our report. This one was from a hookah lounge website. Tired of not being able to go out and dance or hang with your friends since most places won't let you in because you're not 21? Well, head over to our lounge and smoke shisha. So again, really targeting a very young crowd. This shows where the hookah lounge locations are. The Portland metropolitan area, which of course has a number of young adults, kind of flock to the metro region, and then Lane and Benton counties, of course, are where the Oregon State and University of Oregon are located.
So, Madam Chair, so the prohibition of buying tobacco for teenagers does not apply to this. Right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris said it absolutely does. You're not supposed to purchase tobacco until you're 18. However, drinking age is 21, so 18 is the age of an adult. And so, again, that hookah sort of targeting this young crowd or the crowd that's between 18 and 21, which are legal age. Now, that said, hookah lounges are supposed to be carding people to make sure they're of age. That may be variable on how they do that. And then, again, when some of the youth who've reached 18 buy this product, these are clearly being used off-site as well to younger adults. So part of this has to do with the social norm within the younger community. So this graph shows hookah use by youth in counties with and without hookah lounges. So the top line there is 11th grade hookah use in the counties with lounges, and you can see that's the highest line and the highest use. The 11th grade hookah use in counties without is the the dashed light blue line. And then 8th graders aren't using as much as 11th graders, but you can see the 8th graders, the top solid line or the dark solid line there is higher than in 8th graders whose counties do not have hookah lounges. So it's clear that the counties where hookah lounges are present have more kids who have tried using hookah. And in particular, this appears to be appealing to girls. Girls are that dark blue line that you're seeing the most increase. That's 11th grade girls where you've seen the hookah use. The solid line there is boys where it's declined very slightly, although not statistically significant. And then the bottom two dashed lines are the counties or the use in counties without hookah use. I think just in terms of time, I went back, I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. So to summarize, hookah lounges appear to be promoting tobacco use among teens and young adults. And it's clear that in the counties that have hookah lounges and as more of these open, there are more youth who are trying hookah use. And it's growing most among girls. And it appears that these hookah lounges are opening under the smoke shop exemption of the Indoor Clean Air Act. So that's the end of my formal presentation. Did you also get to smell the hookah product? That was part of it, because I think it doesn't smell like tobacco. It does smell more
like brownies.
Yeah, or candy or something like that. So.
Ooh, I didn't like that one.
Yeah, I didn't like it either.
And that's the solid bar, that is the charcoal that is lit. So that one doesn't smell. That's the pieces of the charcoal.
All you get from that is a little black bit on your nose, right?
Yeah.
Is there legislation?
I think.
She should be asking you that.
Yeah, I think Representative Tomei has.
My understanding, and I will be also doing the same presentation in her committee later this week. But yes, introducing House legislation based on closing.
Have you ever visited the country fair in Lane County?
I actually have. Yes, I have. But it was a number of years ago when it was called the Renaissance Fair. I haven't been there recently.
Okay,
that, goes, that tells you how old I am.
Yeah, Morse swears that that's been in
I
the
recognize
fair.
That.
Well, if there are no further questions, thank you very much,
yes,
Dr. Hibbert.
Thank you.
Katie,
you might stay there, Katrina.
I will, but I'm going to...
Which one do you like?
Thank you. I'm going to move. Distracting.
Okay. Next, we're going to go under the state rankings for public health, a report from Dr. Hibbert.
Well, this is something that's... You got to do something like that, right?
God, this is
really difficult.
Lord,
you just missed a great presentation. We all sampled it. We all got a chance to...
Oh, heck. I've known those things forever. What?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg, the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm going to talk just a little bit about a recent report that came out around county health rankings, and I think a copy of the report is being passed out right now. The county health rankings, this is actually a project that was funded by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the University of Wisconsin developed these rankings. And the idea was that they would develop rankings of almost every county in the United States based on national data, but within each state. So it was looking at the health status of a particular county related to the health status of other counties. It was not ranking it around the country. And the reason they did this is because where people live really does matter to what their health status is. And the first step of the process was, it was actually part of a project called MATCH, which is, stands for Mobilizing Action Towards Community Health. And so the first piece is to make communities aware of what their health status is and what kinds of things contribute to the health status of the county so that they can potentially implement prevention programs. The report looked at a variety of things. They looked at sort of what often we think of as sort of the bottom line health status and mortality or actually premature mortality, whether people in particular counties are dying earlier than people in other counties, and then a measure of what the quality of life is. So those are health outcomes. But in addition to the health outcomes, they looked at a number of factors that contribute to health. And these included health behaviors, tobacco use, which I just presented on, diet, physical activity, alcohol use, unsafe sex, and how these health factors contributed. Now, what was a little bit different about this report is they also, in addition to these underlying health risk behaviors, looked at clinical care and how much that contributed to health. And they estimated that clinical care only contributes to about 20% of overall health status. They also looked at underlying social and economic factors believe these contribute to at least 40% of overall health status. Basically, your level of education contributes, as does whether you're employed or not, family support, safety in the community. They looked at violent crime rates and those kinds of things. And last but not least, they did look at some environmental quality, and their measures included air quality as well as density of liquor stores as a marker for the built environment. So what we found in Oregon was that counties ranked again by health outcome, a number of them counties ranked very well. Benton County was at the top of the list. There were other counties, obviously, in the middle. At the bottom of the list were some counties such as Jefferson or other parts of Central Oregon that were a little further away. But each of these counties, one of the things to remember is that there were a number of contributors. So Jefferson County, although they ranked low compared to the health status of other counties, had some of the best air quality in the state. And so, again, the factors in different counties, there aren't counties that are good all across the board or doing poorly. But again, part of this was to help counties identify which were the factors that they might be able to intervene on at the local level. And I think from our perspective, it was also important to say that we, of course, at the Oregon Health Authority and the Public Health Division have certain programs that we implement tobacco prevention, but it's also, as an example, but it's also the responsibility of the health care system as well as others in the community, whether it be education, public safety, and those kinds of things who really contribute to the health status overall. So some of the successes that we've seen in Oregon, again, I alluded or was talking last about the Indoor Clean Air Act, where bars and restaurants are required to be smoke-free. We have menu labeling in Oregon. These are things that, of course, then change the environment that allow people to be healthier. But at the same time, there are big disparities that exist from county to county. And so, again, one of the things that, as part of this assessment, these are some of the data that are available, but counties that are at the local level need to be doing assessments to find out readiness to actually implement some programs to change.
Madam Chair, yeah. If I go online, can I find out what, say, physical environment means in Lane County that makes us at the bottom of the list?
Yes. So, Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, absolutely. There is
steel burning.
There is an excellent website, and it's countyhealthrankings.org, and they do have both all of the metrics, and you can click on your county and find all the metrics. But I think you're correct, as I remember talking about Jefferson County with excellent clean, you know, air, and of course they're up in the mountains and very windy, that some of the counties further down in the valley, whether it be field burning in the summer or wood stove in the fall, you know, that kind of makes the and less wind than you see in the Columbia River Gorge or up in the mountains means that the air quality in the valley is not as good.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Briggs.
We all, you know, immediately go to our own counties and usual stuff, you know, how's our team doing? But my question really is about all the counties. Are the differences in the counties really statistically significant, or are they just very minor differences and they just got ranked? I mean, is there huge gaps amongst various counties? I mean, I could see it in access to health care, Lake County versus Multnomah County, because one's rural, one's not. But the morbidity and mortality, is there really a significant difference amongst the counties?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there, you're absolutely right. There are some indicators, some factors. Overall, Oregon has very good air quality, and I don't have the county report because of printing it out. It was actually quite large. But even that is talking about 1 or 2 days of poor air quality compared to 4 or 5, or even if it's a week. Again, that's very different than some parts of the country that might have, you know, L.A., let's say, with, you know, multiple days of poor air quality. So I think in some of the metrics like air quality, there isn't all that much difference, but there are other indicators in the state that do have a bigger difference between the quality. So just as an example, violent crime rates are higher in the metropolitan area than they are in other parts of the state. That may not be any surprise. Teen pregnancy rates vary around the state. Again, I don't have all of them in front of me, but looking at specific indicators, some of them do show more disparity around the state than do others.
Well, I mean, this goes back to, you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, you know, they'll get you in trouble. And I'd like to see the significant differences among the counties. That would be really meaningful to me.
Okay.
If you could pick that up someday, it'd be nice.
Yeah, Senator Bates. So one of the things that we're trying to do, this report, again, was done at a national level. They used data that were available at the national level from around the country. Some of the smaller counties, in fact, there were 3 counties that we were not able to rank in Oregon because the population is so small that if, you know, one person dies of something this year and next year it's 2, the rate has doubled, but it just means it's one extra extra person. So they combined multiple years of data. One of the things that we would, and they did not include data that might be only available to, in Oregon and not in other parts of the country. So we are very interested in looking at some health indicators that might be relevant to Oregon. One of the other things to be aware of with this report is they're going to be releasing this for at least 3 years. So it's the release is coming out in February again this year and next year. Even if every county improves their health status, these rankings could look exactly the same. Because if everybody improves equally, then you still, there's one county that's going to come in first and one 33rd. Again, there are three counties that were not ranked. So part of this, we've been talking at the national level about having some kind of benchmark so that you could see if the whole state average this year is a C, let's say, did it move to a C-plus and a B-minus and a B. So even if the rankings look the same, the overall health status is improved. So the point is well taken. We actually need more information about how meaningful these are. Just a last comment about it. Again, the motivation behind this was that the first step in trying to change health behavior and community conditions is awareness. So it seems like a lot of people are looking at this report, are interested in what the health status of their county is, and so that was really the intention that was that Robert Wood Johnson had when they released the report initially.
But it is important, I think, for each community to take a look at what their risk factors are in their own county and develop a strategic plan maybe on how to better them. Is that happening at all or not?
So, Madam Chair, that is the exact idea, and actually I've got Jenny Leonard here from Umatilla County who's going to address a little bit about what they've done. Some counties, an assessment, these are statistics, if you want, numerical data, but an assessment of a county also has to do with readiness of the county to do certain things or what, you know, what the community, how they might change it, what they're willing to do. And so those kinds of assessments and a health improvement plan needs to be happening at a local level. So we can do some things at a state level, menu labeling, Indoor Clean Air Act, there are those kinds of initiatives that can be done at a state, but there are a number of things that really need to be addressed at the local level by local health departments or local districts, and that's happening in some parts of the state as well.
Madam Chair, I point out that some of this data is as much as 10 years old, so its reliability may be somewhat questionable.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if I could comment on that. Again, these data are data that are available nationally, and but your point is very well taken. They also had combined multiple years in order to have the numbers be such that they would be somewhat reliable. You wouldn't say the number is 5%, and that varies from 0% to 100%. Then it's not as meaningful. So, again, that's methodology that they had done at the national level. But I do know that point is well taken, because when we were looking at things like economic indicators and unemployment, these data had come from prior to the recession. And so people looked at this and said, unemployment in my county looks at 7%. That's not right. It's 12 or 13. Right. So again, Senator Cruz, that point is well taken.
Other comments?
It just gets back to what Senator Bates said. Statistics are what they are.
That's right.
Well, air quality is something that's persistent and will not change, until the emissions are controlled, until various other things happen. Some areas, including Lane County, and as you drive into Medford, you see this smoke cloud over the city because there's no wind to blow it out. And the configuration is going to always be there. And that's one of the hardest things is the air quality. We have Olympic trials during the worst possible time of the year.
Why is it the worst?
Because of field burning and because of the pollen count
and
so on.
Well,
it's. But anyway.
Here we go. I do think that there are some indicators at each county. That probably won't change. like the high school graduation rate, the college degrees. So when you take a look at some of these things, I think counties can take this information and hopefully be able to do something.
Yeah, so, Madam Chair, I would agree that even though the data are somewhat old, most chronic diseases, the behaviors change relatively slowly. That doesn't mean they don't change. Again, tobacco use having declined markedly in 15 years, but it's taken 15 years for it to decline as much as it has. And I would say the obesity epidemic is exactly the opposite. It's taken us from 1990 to current to basically see the increase that we have in obesity. We're now two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese. So it will take a number of years for that to decline as well.
The same with teen birth rate, chlamydia rate. These are things we need to know about and try to do something about. Thank you. Other comments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jenny Leonard. I'm the administrator from Umatilla County Public Health, and I'm here to kind of tag on to what Katrina has talked about with the county health rankings and provide a bit of a insight into what the locals are doing and how we're combating the issues that we have in our counties. Our health is affected by the communities in which we live, and Umatilla County ranked number 16 for overall health outcomes. We were 30 out of 33 for the health factors. The health behaviors, number 32, clinical care, 29, social and economic, 21, and our physical environment, number 9. Looking at these numbers, it would be pretty easy to feel a little dejected and possibly concerned that we weren't doing good work in our county, but I'm here to assure you that we are, and we're making progress and improvements towards these indicators and in the programs that we implement. Our strengths come in many, many areas. We have a very strong background with our partners and a desire to make a healthy community for our residents. The morbidity or the quality of life was ranked 15 in Umatilla County, and the mortality or the length of life was ranked number 16. This is most likely due, as Katrina mentioned, as to the air quality and to the environment in which we live, which tends to be a fairly clean, rural setting. Some challenges noted in the health rankings are well known by our department under the headers of health behaviors. And under that header, they look specifically at adult smoking, adult obesity, binge drinking, motor vehicle accidents, the teen births, and chlamydia rates. Umatilla County has over 1,300 adults who regularly report smoking and over 2,700 who say that they suffer from serious illnesses as a result of the tobacco use. 142 Umatilla County residents died last year from tobacco. That to me is staggering. $22 million in Umatilla County alone was spent on medical bills, and $23 million were lost as a result of a person's inability to work. This is all a result of our tobacco use. So what are we doing? Well, we receive funding from DHS, and we hire a full-time tobacco coordinator. With that coordinator, we're working and implementing policy changes. In Umatilla County, we've implemented a 25-foot ban from smoking around doorways, air intakes, in all of our county buildings. Additionally, the Public Health Department, along with Youth Services and our addiction services, are now completely tobacco-free centers. Pendleton is also proud to say that they no longer utilize any free tobacco samples. If you went and visited our Pendleton Roundup years ago, you would walk down our main street and you would see Skoll and Copenhagen and all the tents and the girls all in their bikinis and their short shorts, and they'd be passing out cans of chewing tobacco. And that's no longer evidenced in our community. We don't do any free tobacco samples. And that's a huge win for us because our kids are no longer hauling those rolls of tobacco cans and getting their addiction started at such a young age. Our adult obesity rate is growing. In my county, the majority of individuals utilize a car to get to and from all of their locations. We don't have public transportation. The benefit of having public transportation is that you ride your transportation and then you're forced to walk. Not so much in Umatilla County. You drive and you about drop yourself off at the door, and your walking and your exercise is very limited. What the communities are doing to combat this problem is implementing walking and biking paths to encourage folks to be more active and to combat some of our obesity issues. Additionally, in the county, we've implemented a wellness program where we look at the overall health of our county employees. We also do an annual county promotion where we actively push people to be more active in a very friendly competition. You know, we always like to beat out our local county commissioners and say that we walked a little further than they did. This county program also looks at an annual health assessment for anyone that's interested, where they monitor your blood glucose, your cholesterol, and other health indicators. The health department has a shining star in that we implemented a healthy food policy way back in 2008, and I'd like to say that I could take credit for that, but it was not me. It was my staff that came to me and said, enough. Enough of the donuts, enough of the cookies. If we want to have these on our counter, we need to have a healthy alternative. So, you know, at their urging, we implemented a policy that simply states if you want to bring in a snack, fantastic. If it's not healthy, you need to also bring an alternative. Living in Umatilla County incorporates some of those great out west traditions. We have rodeos, horseback riding, ranching. But that also, with that cowboy lifestyle, comes the infamous chewing tobacco and binge drinking. This is pretty accepted in my community. This is a common culture. Alcohol use among our teens is a huge problem. 37.6 of our 8th graders report to having had their first drink before the age of 13. I pause. That just 13. Wow. 33% of 8th graders have drank alcohol in the past 30 days, and 14% have had 5 or more drinks within a couple of hours in the past 30 days. As we all know, alcohol use leads to promiscuous activities. So our teen pregnancy rate is right in there. Girls 10 to 17 years of age, our rate in Umatilla County is 12.7 per 1,000. The state rate is 10.1. Any unintended pregnancy is no good, but it's doubly so when it's a teenager. So the health department is really working diligently to address this issue. We're in all of our schools. We provide multiple classes. We make emergency contraception, birth control methods, all widely available to anyone that's interested on a very confidential basis. The health department is also an active member of RAP, and that's a coalition that stands for Reduce Adolescent Pregnancy Partnership. This is comprised of community partners taking an active role in reducing the teenage pregnancy in the county through a comprehensive approach of community education, advocacy, family service development, and enhancement. We work with this group. We bring in Brad Henning, who's a speaker for Life Resources, and he provides teen summits to over 1,000 eighth graders annually on abstinence education. Additionally, we look at billboards and teen resource cards that we are able to pass out to our local teens. With that drinking and the promiscuous behaviors comes our inevitable chlamydia rate. Just last year, our rate was, we had 213 positive chlamydia cases. That doesn't sound like a lot to you. That's a lot to me for my community, and it has increased. Just the year before, we were at 200. So this is an ongoing issue. We continue to combat STDs in Umatilla County. I know it's not in the water. I think it is. If we could just put some antibiotics out there, I think we'd have this licked. Umatilla County has many, many partners working on creating this healthier environment for our residents, not just a role for public health. We have to be proactive in policy change and implementation. It's going to take the entire village, our hospitals, our medical community, our local business owners, our city and county governments to make these changes, and public health is just one small place on the block involved in this process. So I do appreciate the findings noted in the county health rankings. While this report could leave a county health official feeling a little defeated, my colleagues and I look at this as an opportunity to highlight what we're doing that is working really, really well and the areas that we can do some improvement. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to ask them or answer them for you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Did you start by saying that you got a grant from DHS?
We do receive some money from DHS for our tobacco program.
Okay. Do other counties receive that? Or
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So are you doing, okay, how many other counties are doing what you're doing?
Well, I think to some level we're all doing similar work. It depends upon the county and how that looks.
Okay.
So with the tobacco prevention program, I believe all counties are funded.
Okay.
Well, we need to move on. And so thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Coming. Next, we're going to talk about the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line for Kids, a mental health consultation model for primary care pediatrics in Oregon. Ann Stone, take it away.
Hold it for one moment while we get our technology. We're locked here. Technology wizard.
Colleagues, while we're waiting, I think in your packet, do they have a list of the LCs?
Yes.
Yeah. We will be, I'd like to know if you would like to consider these as committee bills. Okay.
Some of them.
Thank you.
You are going to come visit, aren't you?
From the beginning.
I'm going.
In January or February or whenever the
help is. Technology, our friend and our foe. Good afternoon. My name is Ann Stone, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm the Manager, Director, Head Cheerleader for the Oregon Psychiatric Access Line for Kids, and we have a panel of folks here this afternoon to tell you about this emerging effort for Oregon. Thank you for inviting us. We really are excited about this opportunity that could very dramatically improve mental health integration into primary care, and you're getting a copy of our PowerPoint here for members of the committee. The effort really arose out of a very broad collaborative of leaders around mental health integration into primary care who were looking at things that we could do now with minimal new investment that would provide great outcomes, and we have promising results from other states that we will share in a moment. We want you to think about this, though, not as a standalone program, but rather an opportunity at systems change within child health transformation. As you're looking at things that are coming forward from the Health Policy Board, please remember Opal K as an element in that around the patient-centered medical home, and we'll talk a bit more about that. So we've had great stakeholder involvement and support thus far. The Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health is invested in this, and other national foundations that are interested in child health transformation have put resources into it. And we're just at the point where we have a viable model and partners that are ready to go. And so we're excited to be able to present this to you. So we have a panel of folks here today. To my left, Dr. Art Jaffe, who's a primary care pediatrician and the current president of the Oregon Pediatric Society. To his left, Shelley Joyce, who is a family member from the Oregon Family Support Network, and Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, who's going to be joining us at the table, sitting behind me, who is a psychiatrist and wears two hats in this hearing, one as the current president of the Oregon Council on Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and also as the director of the Division of Child Psychiatry at the Oregon Health Sciences University.
So thank you very much. I really am happy to be here to speak with you all today. Oh, yes, I'm Dr. Arthur Jaffe, the president of the Oregon Pediatric Society and a pediatrician at OHSU. The OPS came to this issue, as we come to all of our issues, thinking how it fits into the work we all do. The OPS is our state chapter, the American Academy of Pediatrics. The OPS is about almost 500 folks in Oregon, part of the AAP, which is a 60,000-plus individual organization encompassing the range of pediatricians. The OPS really is committed to thinking about all of our issues and all of our concerns and all of our actions and suggestions in light of two issues. One is how they're going to improve the health and development of kids in Oregon, and not just kids as isolated individuals, but children and youth who live in families and partake in communities. That is the essence of what we are trying to do. And to help do that, we also have to provide the means to support the pediatricians who care for them. So among the current concerns, not just of the OPS, but I think it's fair to say for all our other folks in Oregon who provide primary care for children and families, are some of the issues related to behavioral mental health issues. This is an extremely common problem. Most of our surveys show that about 35% of all children's visits to the office are somehow related to this. And just before I came down here this morning, I was dealing with a family in crisis, a very lovely, formerly intact, upper-middle-class professional family whose grandma had just died, and 2 days later, the father announced he was leaving his wife and moving in with someone else, and a 9-year-old boy and 6-year-old girl were somewhat distressed. This is an everyday occurrence, not the specifics, but the issues of dealing with the stresses of life. We deal with this all the time. There are issues that adversely impact our ability to provide this care. Patients and their families shift from provider to provider in a semi-random fashion. Kids go into the foster system, they come off of the foster system. They go to the juvenile justice system, they come back out. They have school issues and family, and then they go back to families. Families move geographically around the state. They get services from one another community agency, and then they don't. And all of us are trying to meet some aspect of the needs of these kids and their families, and we can't do it because we have no way of communicating in an effective, positive way with each other. And as we are all aware, kids can actually be harmed by this lack of a worthy system. Kids get prescribed medications they maybe shouldn't get. They maybe don't get prescribed medications they should get. Interventions are designed and started and then stopped in the middle, and other interventions picked up along the way. It's just not a useful system, and hardly is worth being called a system at all. Other concerns that the OPS recognizes, both for ourselves and for our colleagues providing care to children and their families, whether they're FPs or nurse practitioners or other folks working in other areas, I think it's safe to say that many of us feel ill-equipped to be the leaders of teams dealing with these complex problems. For most of us, in pediatrics, if I had wanted to be a psychiatrist, I would in fact have become a psychiatrist. I didn't really want to do that. I have an interest in it and I recognize its value, but it's not my area of expertise. When I or my colleagues are actually having an urgent situation in the office, we often have a hard time getting immediate real-time contact with somebody who's more expert than are we. In a tragic sense, it's really much easier if a child or youth is actively suicidal or actively psychotic, because we can just send them to the nearest ER and basically turf the problem off to somebody else, and they can deal with it, which doesn't do much of anybody any good. But those cases are fortunately the tip of the iceberg. The majority of cases are things that really do fall into the purview of the primary care physician or practitioner, and we just need to be able to get some advice when we need it. And we also have a need for ongoing support and education, both in a general theoretical didactic sense and also an ongoing support to how to manage a given child and his or her family over time to improve our own educational expertise. So, recognizing our concerns, our next thought is what to do about it, how to try and fix it. And the OPS really believes that this is a classic example where it's not going to be good enough just to put a Band-Aid on a problem and figure out some sort of better way of doing now what we've been doing in the past. That this really is a paradigm for really thinking about how we completely transform the system of healthcare and the care we're giving to families. The OPS is committed to this. We've been actively involved in the development of the patient-centered primary care home. We sat on the Medical Standards Committee of OPR that you folks established, and we argued successfully and strongly that mental and behavioral health management really is included in the PCP's role. And while we're talking right now mainly about clinical care for a given child or family, we really recognize our responsibility to work on ways to really improve the care for the population as a whole and to try and do something to bend the cost curve and make it more efficient and cost effective. And we also recognize, again, as I've said, that we're dealing with families in their communities, and we wanted to talk about that.
So as I said at the outset, we really want you to think about this in relationship to a systems change effort in the state rather than an isolated program. So the piece that we'll just briefly share with you is an effort called Help Me Grow. Help Me Grow is a single point of entry information and referral and care coordination. Think of it as a care community hub. Many states have gone down this road. It's a way of linking multiple disciplines around families and around data. And in this state, the Lane County United Way and the Oregon Pediatric Society were awarded a replication grant about 2 years ago to create this system. And what it does is it links people through 211 to information that provides information exchange back and forth. So it's not just information referral that goes out, but it provides feedback and holding of families until they get what they need. But as we were developing Help Me Grow, it was very clear that a critical missing link in creating a continuous learning community around primary care was the mental health piece. So what we've done is we've embedded the OPAL-K model conceptually into this notion that if a primary care provider calls 211 looking for resources around mental health support, they would be warm transferred, so it would be a live call into the OPAL-K line where there is the ability for that mental health expertise to be provided both to primary care but also to connect them to community resources. The last piece I would say about Help Me Grow, everybody, and I do mean this literally, every part of the child system is out creating their own list of the community inventory. Child welfare has their list. Head Start has their list. The nurse manager in primary care has their list. None of them is the complete list, and none of them is up to date. None of them is a real-time, web-based, accessible list of inventory. So it's really hard for people to find what they're needing. So what we're trying to do with Help Me Grow is link OPAL-K to that kind of ongoing growth growing inventory so that people can better find what they need. And Opal K has been part of this discussion around the Help Me Grow system for about the last year and has become one of the priorities out of the Governor's Early Childhood Matters Advisory Council, if that survives the next iteration of whatever leadership around early childhood comes forward in the next administration. But we just wanted to give you that context for this.
So as that keys into Opal K, looking at it from the perspectives of the pediatricians in OPS, we've really been trying to see how we can impact some of these system changes. And what we've been working for, and I think successfully in coming up with the plan you're going to be hearing about Opal K, is that it's really essential to break down these unfortunate silos of care. You have pediatricians in one silo, family practitioners in another, psychiatrists, psychologists all on their own, community agencies, and getting information passed back and forth in an effective way hasn't been working. We need to have a way to actually make that work. And we also, as we do that, as we're increasing the communication and coordination so that we can give care to patients when they need it, we really want to use the same new system to be able to improve education back and forth between different now open silos so that mental health folks learn what some of the issues are, the strengths and liabilities of PCPs in dealing with some of these families, and so that we can learn some of some new skills and talents to deal with them in our home, in our primary care home, as we want to. But that's really the perspective of the primary care docs, most specifically the pediatricians. I think it's also important to talk about the perspective of the families.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Shelley Joyce, and I am a policy advisor for the Oregon Family Support Network. And as Ann mentioned, I am also a family member, three generations now. My son also has mental health issues, and I'm also a consumer of mental health issues myself. I'm here today to put a more personal face on Opal K and maybe indicate to you how families can benefit from this. And I want to give you three scenarios, or three snapshots, if you will, of families who have children with mental, emotional, or behavioral issues and their encounters with their primary care providers. There's nothing wrong with your child. You just need to be a better parent. Children develop differently at different ages, and your child, I'm sure, will just grow out of this. These are the things I heard from pediatricians when my child was very young. But I knew that there was just something different about my child. He didn't play with toys typically. He would line them up. He had sensory issues. He was often defiant and uncooperative. He would tantrum for hours. And when he was upset, he would cry for hours. And these are the issues that I was bringing to these pediatricians. Now, eventually, my son was diagnosed with ADD and bipolar disorder by the time he was in third grade. And in seventh grade, he was identified as being on the autism spectrum with Asperger's. And for the doctors who saw my son early on in his life, they were really caring, well-intentioned doctors, but they just didn't know what they didn't know. And Shauna's daughter was only 11 years old when she began exhibiting signs of depression. And like most families, Shauna took her daughter to her pediatrician who prescribed an antidepressant. Well, within days, her daughter experienced a pretty significant panic attack, and they ended up spending 6 hours in the ER. So they took her off the medication, but unmedicated, and her depression grew worse. And 6 months later, she was back in the ER and back to her pediatrician, who now thought that Shauna's daughter had bipolar disorder and diagnosed psychotropic medications. Shauna didn't believe that this was a correct diagnosis for her child, but she was really hesitant about bringing her child to a psychiatrist. And it took a couple months for her to work through issues around stigma and around labeling that she thought for sure her child would experience. But eventually she did call a psychiatrist, and she was appalled to find out that it was going to be 3 or 4 months down the road before there was an opening for her child. Now, you might think that Shauna lived in a rural area. She lives in Portland, and this is a typical wait time for Portland. And other parts of the state, it's much longer, if you get one at all. So the issues around the shortage of child psychiatrists is very real, but for families, it can be devastating as they wait for months trying to maintain their child until they can get the help that they need. Laura, on the other hand, her 14-year-old son had already been diagnosed with depression, ADHD, and an anxiety disorder by a psychiatrist. But she wanted to go to her family doctor for his medication management. Now, her family doctor already knew about the extensive history of bipolar disorder in her family, and that combined with these multiple diagnoses made him very uneasy about providing this type of care, and he suggested a psychiatrist. And Laura agreed with that because of her family experience. She knew that this was probably the best course of action. But there was a problem here. Laura was a single mom, didn't make very much money. And even though she had health insurance, she couldn't afford a psychiatrist. Because you see, the copay for her doctor was only $20, but the copay to see a psychiatrist was $50, and she couldn't afford it. And when her doctor heard of this dilemma, he reluctantly agreed to start the medication management. Now, I'd like to say that these experiences are few and far between, but I can't, because these things happen all too often with the families that we work with. So what would Opal K have made in a difference for these families? Well, in my own case, my child was exhibiting classic signs of autism at a very early age. A consult would have identified him much earlier at 4 instead of at 12, and the early intervention services could have been started much earlier. For Shauna, at the very least, it would have prevented that long wait for psychiatric services with a consult. And at the best, her doctor could have consulted right away to see what the best course of treatment was for a child this young. And for Laura, whose son had already been diagnosed, the very reluctant doctor could have consulted to see what type of medications and other treatments would have been available and effective for this child. Now, I have no doubt that Opal K will be cost-effective. It can eliminate unneeded visits to the ER. It could eliminate more acute care in a hospital setting, which, as you know, are two of the most expensive types of care that there are. But what matters to me and what matters to families is that their doctors will have immediate access to the information that they need to provide the kind of appropriate and effective care that these doctors could give to their young patients. Oregon Family Network wholeheartedly supports the Opal K Project because we know firsthand from our own experiences and from the experiences of our families that we work with that this service will help improve the lives of families and will help improve outcomes for children. And if there are no questions, I'm going to leave and turn it over to Dr. Jaalani.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us to come speak with you about this project. The project was really started approximately 4 years ago through conversations between pediatricians and...
Oh, say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm very sorry. I'm Ajit Jetmalani. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I am the director of child and adolescent psychiatry at OHSU, as well as president of OCAP, which is the body that serves child psychiatry in Oregon. And I'm here today to talk to you about Opal K in terms of the model development and what we're offering citizens of Oregon. This model really was a development collaboration between first pediatrics and child psychiatry, and now is broadening to a larger consortium of folks who are looking to look at the systems issues, which are a barrier that you've just heard about. And by looking at this with a set of principles that I wanted to outline briefly, one is that we would like this to be a project that actually serves all children and is eventually insurance issues are invisible, so that a person who has a child walk in their office who needs consultation doesn't have to worry about whether the service is covered for their child based on their insurance coverage. This project is intended to support the capacity of the medical home to broaden its capacity to actually deliver service in that setting, which is a preferred setting for receiving services for many folks. They are much more comfortable in primary care office. Primary care providers are not always comfortable being able to deliver all the services that are demanded of them. The model is really focused on what we call the biopsychosocial view of childhood conditions. And by that I mean when children and families present with a concern, the origin of that concern is generally a combination of biological, psychological, and social factors. And if you have to address the comprehensive whole of that in order to have a good outcome. When children come up with symptoms, the solution is not the immediate use of a psychotropic. It's really an analysis of what the issue is and developing an appropriate approach. We wish to implement and recommend evidence-based treatments where those are available and make this a really multidisciplinary approach to mental health needs of children. We would like to develop a system that is financially sustainable and make sure that we have clear criteria that we're analyzing the outcomes of our project. So program evaluation is an important aspect of this. The basic tenets of this program include the opportunity for a primary care provider in a school-based setting and a primary care office to have access to a consultant over the phone the same day that they see the child. And that consultation will, like I said, be focused on a biopsychosocial review of the case and then discussions of options that are available for that child, including a system by which we will collect real-time knowledge of referral resources, have them connected to insurance issues so that we can actually deliver recommendations to the primary care office as to where that person might be best served. In addition to these actually direct services, both to help with referrals, to help with medical treatment recommendations, we also wish to deliver packages of training in various aspects of children's mental health. We would foresee that as both by each case, so when a pediatrician or family practitioner calls, let's say the topic is attention deficit disorder, and there's a question about a particular aspect of that, we would deliver a training module at that moment around that child, but also would plan to have the people who are providing this expertise come to the primary care office and provide a CME or continuing medical education opportunity during the lunch hour, which, in order to develop relationships with the primary care office to the consultants. This model, as I said, has been in development over many years, and it's based on system-wide efforts in other states. A number of other states are ahead of us in this process, and probably the most prominent is Massachusetts. In that setting, the MCPAP program really focused on increasing primary care capacity to be competent to provide for the majority of mental health services that are demanded in that setting, either for referral or actually delivering the care itself. It was interesting that in the MCPAP study, about 34% of the calls that came in were related to diagnostic questions. About 27%, this is over a five-year period, were related to resource reference questions, and about 27% were related to medication questions. The primary care doctors in that program started the program feeling that they were comfortable with mental health issues about 8% of the time. 8% of the practitioners felt they were comfortable with mental health issues. By the end, it was 63% felt comfortable treating mental health issues in their office. And 91% by the end of this project felt that the consultation process was very helpful. PAL is a program in Washington. These are slightly different models, funded differently, structured differently. PAL has actually focused on only the Medicare, Medicaid population. That project has actually focused greatly on training modules, which we will actually be utilizing in terms of various diagnostic categories and how to best address those issues in pediatrics. The St. Cloud model looked at the outcome of their care over a three-year period and found that they were able to reduce the number of hospitalizations in that they saved $1.4 million over 4 years compared to communities in the same state that were not receiving these services. The measurable goals we would like to be able to measure in this project would be increasing the capacity of primary care to provide mental health care, decrease wait time for mental health treatments, decrease inpatient intervention, decrease unneeded medications for foster children, which is already a project, as you know, legislated last year to be monitored and intervened, as well as overall decrease in pharmacy costs. Now, the hope is with the pharmacy piece is that if we deliver a biopsychosocial approach to the evaluation of children and up the skill of the primary care doctor to look at things that way, there'll be less utilization of psychotropics as well as more correct use of psychotropics that are evidence-based and also looking at the cost base of each of those psychotropics. There are medicines that cost $5 a month and others that cost many hundreds of dollars a month that really have the same efficacy. How much does this cost? The program in Massachusetts costs approximately 18 cents per member per month per child. OPAL-K project is estimated to range in the same arena, around 18 cents per member per month. We are working right now with soft monies from public and private insurers to get this project moving. We have found a great deal of interest. This makes sense to insurers who we've spoken to, based on the potential of cost offset and improving quality of care. I'm going to stop there with questions. I want to note that, unfortunately, you don't have a packet of information with details about this project, and we will get that to you. But I'd be happy to answer questions and then hand it over to Ann to finish.
At this point, what do you think the role of the legislature would be here? I mean, you're saying public funds. Is there going to be legislation?
Okay, I'm going to turn that question over to Ann.
Chair Monis Anderson, yeah, we've actually had quite a bit of dialogue about what to do in dastardly times. So clearly there could be revenue implications for this in a public-private partnership, but now is not the time. So what are the places where, as you're looking at primary care patient-centered primary care homes, and as you're looking at the Health Policy Board recommendations, what are the pieces that would support the rollout of a project like OPAL-K? Clearly, one of the huge barriers in the system is the ability for primary care practitioners to be able to bill some kind of global care coordination codes. What happens now is any kind of non-FaceTime that happens within primary care doesn't fit any of the boxes. The current billing codes don't work. So what happens is they just give the time away, and they can't support the kind of care coordination in their office that it would take to do a good integrated health, mental health, primary care home. So that's a key. That's a huge issue moving forward, and that's going to come forward out of the recommendations that Dr. Jaffe had referred to earlier out of the patient, the primary care patient-centered. I hate that. Couldn't they have come up with something easier? Too many initials. So that is a critical piece of this. The other is that what happens in primary care when a physical health practitioner is seeing a mental health condition is they bill for comorbid physical health issues, because if they do the mental health diagnosis, it gets turned down. So what that does is it skews the data. We really don't know the level of mental health care going on, and you create yet another twisted system around the problem. So one of the things we're looking for is mental health billing diagnosis parity, for lack of a better term, the ability for PCPs to be able to bill for mental health conditions and not the gut or the headache or the sleep or whatever the comorbid physical health conditions. Clearly, we would be looking for your guidance around changes in, you know, as the Health Policy Board recommendations come forward, in what those kinds of policy packages might look like. And as we're looking for startup funds, we will certainly be thinking about what the long-term finance model looks like for this, and be back in 2 years when there's an opportunity perhaps for some state-level partnership with the public resources rather than the local managed care organizations.
Have you been a part of the discussions, when they're talking about the health exchange and the essential benefit package? I haven't been attending those committees, and Senator Morse is going to be chairing that piece that'll be coming forward. And I was just curious as to where mental health is, or how mental health is being considered in the essential benefits package. I don't know if anyone at the table would know either.
No, the OPS wasn't. We were only on the PCPCH Medical Standards Advisory Committee. We didn't have any input to the other two committees.
Because this will be part of the discussion. Right now, when someone goes into the ER and they, Legacy was saying, over half of their admissions are oral health, but then another big percentage is mental health, and yet they can't bill for any of those things. They need to, they can treat the infection, but they have to refer to, what is it, behavioral health or wherever. So this is a huge issue that we need to be addressing, but I don't have the answers. Any comments?
So, Chair Monson, if I could comment on that last remark. One of the issues that we've dealt with all along in the planning of this is, as Dr. Jet Malani had said, keeping this insurance blind, because what the primary care providers will tell you is that referring to specialty and subspecialty for other issues is nowhere near as complex as mental health. As soon as it becomes a mental health issue, the dance begins around what insurance, what coverage, what plan, what providers, Medicaid, private, mix, and the treatment is dictated by that sort of gymnastics that happens at the level of primary care. So whatever we can do that simplifies that, removes the silos, and brings the health mental health integration really into alignment in the payer system is what kind of policy issues that we've been discussing. And you know, my hat goes off to you in this coming session to try and drill down through the recommendations coming out of the health fund health policy board around that.
Just a quick comment. I'll try to keep my Senate hat on as long as I can. You're right. All the things you said, you really go into a gray area with children, especially kids. You know, kids are more difficult to diagnose as they progress, as they get older. They're often diagnosed or missed early, as you all know. And we have really a shortage of child psychiatrists in the state, and probably across the nation. I don't think we're much different. And to say that primary care physicians are uncomfortable with those diagnoses is a vast understatement. And so it's difficult. And things move faster with kids, too. So you're really under the gun. I'm just trying to get my mind around what you're really telling us here, this 2-1-1 system, and trying to think of through it for an individual patient and where the funding would come from. And my first thoughts on funding is OHP and the children's initiative we have going on for 1%. If we can show cost savings, it should be something we can deal with from that point of view. The real thing I'm trying to put my mind around is a physician sitting there with a child in front of him that he's unsure of the diagnosis but senses that there's something really significant going on. Is it Asperger's? Is it autism? Is it a general anxiety disorder? Is this child depressed? Is there a bipolar component to this? Is this a normal behavior for a 3 or 4 or 5 year old? Will developmentally resolve itself or not? So they call in to this 211 line.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's the expectation? I mean, is that calling the poison control line and getting some help, or what are we talking about here?
So they would call into the line, and they would actually be directed to because 211 would address more than just mental health issues, so they would get directed to mental health.
Yeah.
And the person who would answer the phone would be a trained clinician in the area of mental health. who would determine with the provider if they're looking for referral information or if they're looking for a consultation. If it's a consultation from a clinician, then that would be set up at that moment for that same day. And the provider would then speak to a child psychiatrist who would go over the case with them. And in these other programs around the country, about 10% of those ended up in a face-to-face consultation, and we would use telemedicine for rural health care. By the way, this is a joint effort between community and the medical school, so this is not all medical school driven. We would have providers in regions where there are providers who would be willing to sequester some of their time to provide support to primary care. So it could be telemedicine or direct face-to-face consultations in about 10% of the cases. The rest of the cases were actually managed over the phone through communication and the potential follow-up calls. And as I mentioned, the statistic, people felt comfortable over years of experience that their skills were upgraded. This was a satisfactory process for them. This is not a solution to all mental health care, and it also doesn't replace direct care by psychologists and therapists and child psychiatry. Those services still need to be in place. This is actually improving the process of accessing those, supporting the primary care office in the process of access as well, and kind of winding their way through the system. We would hope to promote and support co-location of non-MD providers in primary care offices, like having psychologists and social workers in the office, and having the child psychiatrist actually consulting to that team of folks when there are troubles.
So right now you were just referring to PCPs, but what about psychologists? What about or social workers or even school counselors? I mean, would they be, or would you be taking calls from them too? I mean, I would think the system would get overloaded.
Well, I think we designed it on purpose to start out thinking you had to start somewhere, and it just happened to be our two professional organizations. But I think we want this eventually to grow and thrive, and it really should be available over time to all professionals dealing with all kids in Oregon.
So, Senator Monis-Anderson, could I also add that the issue of help me grow and Opal K is really salient to what you're talking about, because the notion of help me grow was to create a single point of entry for anybody looking for support for children and families that could link them to those kinds of community resources. So if we can figure out how to provide this level of care in primary care and increase the access to services for those folks who come in from all those other doors, our hope is that will, you know, raise all boats, that it'll be easier for folks to connect around a team around the family with that part of the system in place. It's very hard to pull any of these parts apart and talk about how they would work on their own.
Mm-hmm. FQHCs?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anything that the legislature should be doing with this? Are you submitting a bill?
Thank you, Chair, for bringing that up. Yes, there's a bill that's in process now, and as soon as we get the draft back, we'll look at the policy implications around that, and then we'll see how the session unfolds around what kinds of pieces come out of the Health Policy Board work groups.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this is coming to the Health Authority then, the bill?
Well,
I mean, it would be logical to come through them. Is that where's
if that's your recommendation?
Who's dropping the bill? I mean,
well, at this point, Senator Monis-Anderson's office has started the process.
We've started the process, Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Yeah, we have a half hour left and. An hour and a half. Oh, we got plenty of time. All right. The next is establishing a durable medical equipment licensing board. Robert Lee, if you could come up. And I think it's important, I don't know if any of you saw this on 60 Minutes about the abuse in Medicare fraud with durable medical equipment. So when Robert Lee came to talk to me about this, I said, let's
look at that in the committee. So, Robert?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Lee. I am the President-elect and Legislative Committee Chair for the Pacific Association of Medical Equipment Services, but I'm here representing my employer, Care Medical Equipment. Care Medical Equipment was established over 40 years ago and provides durable medical equipment such as walkers, wheelchairs, complex rehabilitation equipment, oxygen supplies, and the such. I'm here to advocate for the establishment of a self-funded or budget-neutral licensure program consisting of a 7-member board under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency in order to inspect, verify, and ensure compliance with supplier standards through a state licensure program to legitimate the DME suppliers here in Oregon. Unfortunately, our industry, time and time again, has been systematically taken advantage of by organized criminals who have taken their obligation to infiltrate the Medicare and Medicaid system because it's cheap and easy money. White-collar crime, very easy to do. Unfortunately, we have all these supplier standards that nobody's enforcing. National Supplier Clearinghouse, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. While we have the supplier standards, they're not enforced, and oftentimes they're just overlooked. I've included with my packets several documents, various articles talking about how healthcare insurance fraud is becoming more profitable and it's just being not enforced. One of the more recent ones was by Willamette Week that had to do with an article called The Sopranikovs, where somebody who had no medical experience whatsoever came in, set up shop, billed Medicare for millions of dollars, found it very lucrative, and ran off. Even after they were indicted, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services continued to process their bills. They continued to process the claims and continued paying on those, even after they were already out of the country. This chronic lack of enforcement has developed a status quo within our industry, and I certainly believe that a licensure program would allow adequate enforcement of those standards and ensure that patients, providers, insurance companies in the state are not being taken advantage of. Recently, I was looking at some of the more recent data from CMS. The best estimate that I can get is approximately $11 million per year are basically taken out of the Medicare system for Oregon alone. That's not including state Medicaid. That's not including the commercial plans. This type of a program would actually reduce overall health care costs, would also help minimize costs for the insurers who have to go through various forms of insurance compliance. And I really don't know how much more I can really speak to that other than having a member.
Basically then, right now you don't, anyone can set up a shop and bill Medicare, and how they get their provider numbers, they can take patients' numbers, somehow get patients' numbers, and they can just start billing.
Yes.
And Medicare has been reimbursing without really any verification that it's a legitimate business. So by setting up a health licensing entity before anyone could bill, they must then be licensed in the state of Oregon.
Correct.
So basically that's what the bill does.
Correct.
It provides a venue so that these billings, we would cut down the fraudulent billings. Is that
absolutely
what you think?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Where is the Attorney General's office in all this?
I've spoken with Keith Dubanovich and proposed that idea and was told that we are able to do that. And actually, the first supplier standard, which you have a list, supplier standard number one, a supplier must be in compliance with all applicable federal and state licensure and regulatory requirements and cannot contract with an individual or entity to provide licensed services. Oregon does not have a licensure program, which is quite interesting because there's 21 other states across the nation that do have licensure programs. We just simply have not implemented one yet.
And in talking with the DHS folks, they feel that there is fraudulent billing going on also. So I think that they will be on board. I think Amy's somewhere around.
My question really was, does the Attorney General's office think this is the right thing to do as far as cracking down these people and getting a better handle on that, whether they were, you know, whether they just didn't care? I mean, this is a, you know, it's consumer fraud and government fraud, and that's where they do most of their work,
correct,
a lot of their work, I should say. So do you think that this is a step in the right direction? Are they neutral?
I honestly haven't gotten any official position from them, but from my discussions, they would be supportive of it. But that's not an official position.
Okay.
I think you'll see that this is a committee bill put before us today.
Great.
Oh, no, that's right. No, that's my personal. Well, never mind. It's not a committee bill. All right. Any other questions? Thanks.
Thank
so
you.
Much, Robert. All right. Now, Andy Ammon and John DiLorenzo to talk to us about the role of the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center at OHSU in the prevention and treatment of diabetes.
Crank up the cash.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here on behalf of Harold Schnitzer. Also substituting for Dr. Ammon is Don Kane, who is with the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Care Center. Today, there are 24 million Americans afflicted by diabetes. 10.7% of all adults suffer that affliction. In Oregon, the population afflicted by this disease has risen from 5.3% in 1999 to 7.5% in 2009. In the next 25 years, diabetes in the United States will likely double to 44 million cases, and the direct costs will nearly triple from $113 billion nationally in terms of 2007 numbers to $336 billion in terms of 2007 dollars. These staggering proportions will most certainly impact Oregon in much the same way. Harold Schnitzer, my client, is a philanthropist. He is also a diabetic who has lived with this disease much of his adult life. The Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Center, established in July of 2007, has been the beneficiary of a $5.6 million donation by Mr. Schnitzer's private foundation. The medical community has been searching for a cure for diabetes for decades. Finding a cure will likely take decades more. In the meantime, the disease will affect a significant portion of our population and must be managed so that those who suffer from it can live productive lives, and so our state can avoid the catastrophic costs that will otherwise occur if nothing is done in the interim. We have invited each of you to tour our facility this Friday. We hope that most of you can come to witness how firsthand the great work, the great things that the center is accomplishing. But in the meantime, and for those of you who cannot attend, I have asked Don Kane, the center's outreach coordinator, and one of the medical professionals on the staff, he's a dietitian, to elaborate a little bit on the work that the center is doing. And so, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like Mr. Kane to address you.
Proceed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's an honor to be here this afternoon. I'm representing the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Health Center on behalf of Andrew Ammon, who's our medical director. And as John mentioned, I have to state my name, did I?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm Don Kane. I'm a registered dietitian, certified diabetes educator, and I've been working in the field of diabetes for about 20 years now. And over the course of my time working with diabetes, I've seen it more at the primary care level. A couple of years ago, we moved to Oregon from California, and I had the honor of having the opportunity to take a position with the Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center. And as far as diabetes treatment, there's not a finer center to treat diabetes that I've seen. As John mentioned, 24 million Americans have diabetes, and that's about 11% of our adult population. If current trends continue, 1 in 3 children born in the year 2000 will develop diabetes in their lifetime. So we're going to go from 11% to about 33%. If one of those children is African American or Latino, it ends up being 1 in 2 children developing diabetes in the course of their lifetime. Having known Mr. Sinzer and worked with Mr. Sinzer, his model for our diabetes center is ideal. The Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center is one of the only centers in the country, the only center west of the Rockies that actually delivers diabetes care to both adults and children under the same roof. So we have a team of board-certified endocrinologists, both adult endocrinologists and pediatric endocrinologists, as well as a team of certified diabetes educators that includes registered nurses, registered dietitians. We have a pediatric social worker as well as a child psychologist. So theoretically, a person could develop diabetes in infancy and through the course of their life cycle have seamless care. And that's Mr. Sinzer's vision for the Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center. In addition to providing outstanding diabetes care, the Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center is responsible for training many endocrinologists in the state of Oregon, as well as other adjunct health professionals, registered dietitians, nurses, pharmacists, all rotate through our center and benefit from the center's existence. The Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center has a strong history of collaborating with local and national diabetes advocacy groups, including the American Diabetes Association, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, the Oregon Diabetes Educators Association, and on the state level, the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Division of DHS. Historically, the bulk of the above-mentioned groups and the Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center have worked together under the auspice of a diabetes coalition. Unfortunately, in 2009, the state administrative support for this coalition was terminated by the reappropriation of finances within the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Division of DHS. So we're looking to maybe reestablish that connection in a formal way if that's possible. From my standpoint, part of what I do is I see patients 12 hours a week, and I'm also responsible for diabetes outreach. We received a very generous grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust to initiate our diabetes outreach, and to date, the bulk of our diabetes outreach has been targeted towards Jefferson and Douglas counties. And we targeted these two counties because of the increased prevalence of diabetes in these two counties, as well as the ethnic mix that makes these two counties more susceptible to developing diabetes. In terms of what we've been doing, we went into both of these communities and identified some of the leaders in the communities and asked them, how can we help you? And what we heard universally from the leaders in the communities, specifically the diabetes educators, is that they would like some diabetes education materials that are non-pharmacy branded that can be used, just that are easy to read, they're easy to follow, they can be used at a community level. We responded to that request by developing 27 individual diabetes education materials freestanding that are not branded other than they do say the Harold Sinzer Diabetes Health Center because we created them. We've shared those to date with 5 entities in Douglas and Jefferson County. That's 2 hospitals, 2 federally qualified health centers, and the Warm Springs Wellness Center on the Warm Springs Indian Reservation requested the materials as well. So that's where we started with our outreach effort, and that's been very well received. In Douglas County, we're very proud to have Douglas County host the first recognized diabetes prevention program community-based in the state of Oregon. In August, we trained 14 members of the community to actually facilitate a 16-week diabetes prevention program where participants meet every week to learn about lowering their calorie intake. The goal is 7% weight loss and 30 minutes of physical activity per day. this diabetes prevention program is actually being hosted at the Central Douglas County YMCA and another entity in town called Active Life Fitness. We're very proud to kick off our diabetes prevention program in Roseburg at the Central Douglas County YMCA with 18 participants. So the community is really taken to the idea of diabetes prevention and are very excited about the work that's being done in Douglas County. In Jefferson County, in addition to the educational materials we've shared, we rounded up all the diabetes providers in the community and had them actually write a newspaper article on what we call the keys to controlling diabetes. The keys to controlling diabetes are checking blood sugar, eating healthy, being physically active, taking medications as prescribed, and having someone supportive in your life that knows you have diabetes and supportive in your journey with diabetes. So we put some advertising time in the advertising space in the Madras Pioneer and the Spillier Taimu, which is the newspaper for the Warm Springs Reservation, and ran these articles. And we culminated these articles, which were written by diabetes providers in the community, with an event we called Dine with the Diabetes Experts. And what we did is we opened it up to the public and ran. We just catered a meal, a healthy meal, and the experts came and spoke to the people, and we did this in Madras and Warm Springs, and it was very well received. And I participated in both events personally, and through those events, we were able to hook up the diabetes educator locally with a couple of people that were in dire need of diabetes education and just coordination of care. So that was a very, very positive experience for us. In addition to our Dine with the Diabetes Experts intervention, we recorded 8 public service announcements related to diabetes prevention, diabetes management in Spanish for the Spanish-speaking population in Central Oregon. These public service announcements are anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute long, and they're being played during the month of November, which was National Diabetes Month, at intervals over the primary Spanish-speaking radio station in Central Oregon. So that's the part of diabetes outreach that I'm actively involved with and very proud to be part of. In addition to what we're doing in Jefferson and Douglas counties, we're doing an intervention in the Dalles, where the Mid-Columbia Medical Center reached out to us and said, do you have an endocrinologist that can advise us, that can help us? So we now send an endocrinologist from our diabetes center to Mid-Columbia Medical Center on a monthly basis just to see patients and as well as consult with their physicians. In Portland, for the past 3 years, the 3 years that the Harold Sensor Diabetes Health Center has been in existence, we've hosted an annual Pacific Northwest Diabetes Health Summit. The first 2 years, the summit was primarily public health oriented, and this year we made it a little bit more patient oriented. We're very pleased to have over 225 people show up for an event that was devoted to patients and families with type 1 diabetes. So that's just a brief update of what our center has been up to, and we hope to see you this Friday if you can make the time to come visit our center.
Thank you. I plan to be there, and I don't know if...
I'll be treating diabetics in my office.
You'll be treating
them. Okay. I like your material. I'd like to see
That's a valid excuse.
To. Yeah, thank you.
Will you be able to attend, Senator Moore?
I'm not sure what my schedule is.
Okay, how about you?
I'm having all-day meeting with DHS folks in Douglas County Department of Health to see what we can do to streamline their operation.
Oh, good.
Okay.
So,
sounds good. Sounds good.
Have one at least.
Well, Madam Chair, to the extent some of the senators cannot make it, they are more than welcome to send staff or any other substitutes that they think might be appropriate. So we'd be happy to host them, too.
Thank you.
A quick question. One of the things you touched on was materials to give patients.
Yes.
And it is difficult to find materials to give patients. I recently did an internet search for American Diabetic Association just for a series of diets, and it's very difficult to get through that and get anything printed out.
Right.
So if you've got that kind of material, is it available for anybody in the state, and can we purchase it from you?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that material is absolutely available as long as the entity is serving patients and not profiting from it. And I have a copy of the materials that I'd be happy to share with you if you'd like to have a copy and browse through.
Yeah. This would be things we put in the lobby and we give patients to help with their care.
Absolutely.
We'd love to see that spread further.
Yes.
We need a good source of information for patients.
Great. Senator Bates can do internet searches now?
I'm getting better. Got a long ways to go. Okay. That's probably why I couldn't do it. You know?
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We truly appreciate the time.
Thank you for the time. Us.
Next, medical treatment of diabetes, Tom Boyer from Novo Nordisk.
Hey, thanks. Is there a place we can, is there something inside we can, yeah. Should,
you could go offline.
Come on. Talk.
Thank you. Chairman Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you for the time and making time to discuss diabetes today. My name's Tom Boyer. I have about 27 years of advocacy work in the diabetes space nationwide and in states and at the federal level. I'm here representing a company called Novo Nordisk. We've got about 87 years of work in the diabetes space, primarily in the insulin area. We are the leading manufacturer of insulin in the United States, but that's all I'm going to talk about related to my company today. Over the last several years, my company's been sponsoring an awful lot of research related to diabetes and action related to diabetes nationwide. And what we're finding is causing us enough alarm that we think it's imperative upon those of us that have an interest in safeguarding the lives of patients to begin to speak up. And that's why I'm here today. The primary concern that my company has right now is that Oregon is looking at a quadrupling of the diabetes population over the next 30 years. That will happen. I can guarantee it based upon statistical trends put forth by CDC, unless dramatic action occurs. And in that quadrupling, you will see a quadrupling of your budget, assuming health inflation remains constant, attributed to diabetes. Today, the state contributes or allocates about $2 billion per year to the treatment of diabetes among your citizens and residents. That figure will go in excess of $8 billion within the next 30 years. And I just don't know if the state is prepared for that type of a financial obligation, because it is going to be a rather heavy lift when you look at the complications attributable to diabetes, heart attack, stroke, kidney failure. Now, my company will be here supplying insulin to those patients when they get those complications, but we don't want to be in that position. We would much rather ensure that patients are preventing those complications from occurring and that they get the care that they need. So you have a copy of my testimony in front of you. I'm going to stray heavily from it. I encourage you to read it because there's a lot of information, a lot of data, a lot of comparison to other states as to what's going on in other states. But unfortunately, you have an opportunity to be a trailblazer here to fight diabetes because, unfortunately, there really isn't a whole lot going on in any other state. The budgets are not available. If you look at the budget for the Oregon prevention program, for the Oregon Diabetes Prevention Program, the budget is $800,000 per year to fight a disease that's costing your economy $2 billion a year. I don't know if you can run a sustainable and credible model to actually blunt the rate of increase related to diabetes on an $800,000 a year budget that comes from the Centers for Disease Control. And by the way, that budget was cut $36,000 last year. So at the time that the epidemic is exploding, the Centers for Disease Control is allocating less and less in terms of resources to states to fight diabetes. The nationwide budget alone to fight diabetes from a prevention perspective is $28.5 billion, and that includes the territories. The largest budget in the entire United States to fight diabetes goes to the state of California, and that is just north of $1 million. That's what we're dealing with here. That's the economy of scale that we're dealing with. Now, I fully appreciate the position that you as legislators are in with the budget dynamic that exists here in the state, that you need to find credible, affordable, reasonable solutions to this problem. I would be lying to you if I told you that I had them. and anyone else in this position would be doing the same. There are no easy solutions to this problem. So what I encourage you to do is to follow the lead of some other states in this area, most importantly Texas and Kentucky, who in the next legislative session will consider legislation that requires departments that have a role in safeguarding the interests of people with diabetes while also having a fiduciary role in paying for the care of people with diabetes. Those legislatures will consider legislation that requires those entities to assess what they're currently doing in the diabetes space and to gauge the effectiveness of those programs and protocols. Then plan ahead for the next 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 10 years to say what they would do in order to combat the problem. And then also assign a budget to it with a range of options that are available to you as legislators so that you can make appropriate decisions on how best to fight this disease, because the answer is not going to come from Washington, D.C. And also with diabetes being different from state to state, you need to have the flexibility to implement programs that really work in your communities and provide a solution to your communities. Things that reach the Native American population, things that reach the Asian American population, African American population, Latino, Latina. You need, and it's different in every state and it's different in every locality. So right now, Representative Esquivel has drafted a bill and has it pre-filed, and it would be my hope that you would seriously consider this legislation when the legislature convenes in the next year, because my fear is that if we continue to be inactive on the diabetes front, we will not have the opportunity to engage diabetes on our terms, and instead diabetes will be dictating the terms under which we engage it. And that's not a very fun place to be as a person who's had diabetes for 27 years. The tools that are available enable people to manage it correctly as long as the tools are available to them, as long as the care and services are available to them, and as long as they are encouraged to get them at the appropriate time and focus on what they need to. So my hope and my encouragement is that we get a little bit more information out of those entities that serve people with diabetes, that serve your taxpayers, that have a fiduciary role, and can then act accordingly. They're the best and the brightest that you have available. They're the smartest people in the world when it comes to diabetes. I can attest to it. The folks at the Schnitzer Diabetes Center are fantastic. I have visited with their folks over the years. You have the tools that are available. Just give them the opportunity to give you some direction. And in turn, you can make the appropriate decisions as you move forward. And with that, I yield back the balance of my time. Thank you very much for your time.
What does the legislation ask for?
It simply asks those entities that have a fiduciary responsibility. So in this case, we're talking about
Medicaid.
We're talking about Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan. We're talking about the Public Employees Benefits Board, and we're talking about the Oregon Diabetes Program to document what they do. Now, you'll see in your packet that there's a letter that Representative Call initiated to the department asking some very specific questions about what it is that they're doing right now. That's the type of report that I would hope you would get from each of the entities, documenting what they do, telling you what their substance of work is, and require them to do it on a biennial basis, and then you can budget and act accordingly. That's really the goal of the legislation.
Okay. Question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there's almost like a two-pronged approach. I mean, prevention is one thing, but I remember a conversation I had with Newt Gingrich about a decade ago, and he basically told me that nationwide, diabetes was the most expensive preventable disease, or it's not preventable, but manageable disease in the United States. And so, and you know, whether you get one or two, once you've got it, you've got it. However you got it doesn't really matter at that point. And so it seems to me that it's all, with all the other things we're doing with obesity and stuff like that, kind of drive towards a point I'm just wondering if the focus in diabetes ought to be disease management more than anything else.
Chair Monizan-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, I agree with your premise entirely. Here's the sad reality of where we are, and very few people are willing to engage in this discussion. Diabetes is here to stay. It just is. And we have to provide the tools and make the tools available that enable people to manage it in the most effective way possible as a means to controlling or blunting the rate of increase of that $2 billion to whatever it's going to be next year and the following year. And the best way to do that is to provide appropriate, consistent, and constant care to those patients. If you miss a few insulin injections, your blood sugars, and you have type 1 diabetes, you're in the emergency room. That's not an appropriate outcome for the taxpayers of the state. That's a real tough lesson.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the diabetes itself that caught, that's the expense. It's everything that happens when you don't manage your disease, and it's so subtle because once you're out of balance, your brain does weird things in many cases, and it gets progressively worse. So, I just think, I mean, we've talked disease management in this building for a long time, and probably one of the most cost-effective things we can do is appropriate disease management, whether we're talking diabetes or you know, heart disease or whatever it is we're talking about. So I just wanted to get that on the table.
Well, with our health exchange, our essential benefits package, we're going to, part of the goal is to have chronic disease management as a part of that essential benefit package. We'll see if that's what comes out, but... Yeah.
If I could add one more thing, Chair Monizan-Anderson, to the commentary that's here, I think the key and most important thing to do is, I've been involved in health insurance advocacy for far too many years to count, and helping people interact with their health insurance plans and people who are purchasing health care. The most important thing that you can do is to get some form of documentation, at least in the diabetes space, because of the amount of services that are involved, that the benefits are actually being provided and that the care is actually being provided and that the metrics and the outcomes are actually being met. And by getting this report and getting some documentation of this, you will go a long way towards obtaining information and getting an appropriate dialogue started about what diabetes is doing in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. With that, we'll go, another piece of legislation we'll be considering this next session is modernization of physician assistant licensing. And we would like to have Ed Way, Ted Robach, and Tom Holt.
Good afternoon, Chair Monizan-Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Holt here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and some of you know I've never been so happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you here.
Thanks. Our purpose today is really just to queue up what we're going to be discussing in the session, what OSPA has been working on with stakeholders up to this point. Currently, just to set the table, the way physician assistants are licensed through the Oregon Medical Board, and there's a requirement in Oregon that stems from the early days of when physician assistants were first licensed, that a practice description is filed and has to be approved by and in detail by the board, both when the PA is initially licensed, if there's any change that takes place in the PA's practice, so if there's something additional that the PA's supervising physician wishes the PA to do, that's another new approval process. And then if a PA changes places of employment or change of practice. What the bill intends to do is really change that process administratively. I want to be really clear that there is absolutely no intent to change the scope of practice. It's the intention.
Thank you.
To change.
So now we're really happy to see you. Now we're really happy to see you here.
To change the administration. And And so the bill that you will see will call for, instead of a description going to the medical board for approval, to have a practice description committed to writing that is on file with the supervising physician and the PA. Very open to having a filing of that with the medical board if they so desire, but not have that be an approval process. So, because it's very important to maintain accountability in case something does go wrong, and also you know, just to have a real good, clear understanding of who is doing what in the practice. The other piece in the bill is to clarify a section of statute about which there's been some differing interpretation over the years, and that has to do with informed consent. It's not a generally delegatable authority, but it stands to reason that for those activities that a PA is engaged in, that the PA ought to be able to take care of those things. Don't want to be in a position where a physician could say, oh, goody, I can delegate all the all of that authority for all things in the practice to the PA. So with that, I'll stop. I just wanted to let you know that we are very much actively engaged in conversation with stakeholders, and we'll refine the bill language that, Sanderson, that you have before this thing gets all the way through the process for sure. So with that, I just want to turn this over to Edwin Way. He is a primary care practitioner in Oak Ridge, and he'll tell you a little bit about his practice.
Good afternoon, Senators. And Senator Cruz, we've met before. You were very helpful in a previous bit of change in our legislation, getting us so that we could sign death certificates and schedule two narcotics. I'm Edwin Way. I'm a PA. I graduated more years ago than I want to admit to from Emory University. And I'm here to give kind of the guy in the trenches point of view. I do not wish a change in my scope of practice. I'm very happy. What I want is to be allowed to do what I've been trained to do and have been doing for many, many years until the last four or five, which is really the issue with all of this. I work in Oak Ridge, Oregon. We have a catchment basin of around 5,000 patients. I am now the only provider in town. About four years ago, a DO shut down his practice and moved. And then last month, the other provider, a DO, shut his practice down and is now doing urgent care at Peace Health. And so I'm it. And my hands are a little bit tied sometimes. About 7-8 years ago, there was a change in what the board required of me personally, and I'm just speaking personally now, in what I could and couldn't do. And a short story. I had a lady before all this occurred who came in. She was 60 years old, and you will understand this. She had vaginal bleeding. So I performed an endometrial biopsy. Turned out that she had endometrial carcinoma. I had her into my surgeon, a fellow that's really receptive to my practice, within that week. And we performed surgery and took out the uterus and quite possibly saved her life. I am now no longer allowed to do endometrial biopsies because the board thinks that's beyond what I am capable of doing. They asked for documentation. Well, when my documentation was acquired, it was all on 3x5 cards. There were no computers that we could keep that sort of record. That's one of the issues. Another thing that the board doesn't think I'm capable of doing is reading EKGs. I do this all the time. I know when an EKG is wrong. I may not know that it's, you know, a first degree bundle branch block that I cannot worry about, or one if I've got some other criteria going along I need to worry about. But I know it's wrong. I send it to my cardiologist. That cardiologist wrote a letter for me to the board stating he's perfectly competent to read EKGs. Let him do it. They turned this down. The board has become a privileging agency, not a regulating agency. And it's really restricting my ability ability to provide good, high-quality care to the citizens of my community in Oak Ridge, and I'm sure that that is going on statewide, too. I don't really have any other things to add to this, but I thank you very much for your time, and I'm open to questions.
So your supervising physician is located where?
He is an emergency room and urgent care physician that comes up once a month to review charts that are required by Medicare, which requires 10% of my charts to be reviewed. And he spends an afternoon or a day reviewing charts, and then we spend about an hour discussing these charts and ways that I can improve or change or give me insights.
And he is perfectly well aware of your competency. Basically, it's a competency issue.
A competency issue?
On like doing an endometrial biopsy.
I don't view it as a competency. I mean, every PA coming out of school has been trained to do this. I feel this is just something I've always done, and now I'm no longer allowed to do it. He, my physician, Alex Morley, is quite comfortable with me doing these things.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson and the rest of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ted Ruback. I am the director of the Physician Assistant Program at Oregon Health and Science University, the founding director of that program. And I come here today primarily to add to the story a little bit from the inside. Until very recently and for the past 4 years, I have served as chair of the Physician Assistant Committee of the Oregon Medical Board. For approximately 6 years before that, I served as an observer for the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants to the Physician Assistant Committee of the Oregon Medical Board. So I've been following very closely the work of the Physician Assistant Committee for approximately 10 years now. The primary purpose of this legislation that we're hoping to bring forward is, and I feel like I can really speak to this, is that I really believe that the abilities and the competencies, as you referred to earlier, of what a PA can do is best determined by the supervising physician that works with that PA in a remote area or most commonly on a day-to-day basis with that supervising physician. The way things stand presently now is that a PA and their supervising physician submit an application. Along with that application comes a practice description that defines what a PA will be doing in their practice. And the first decision made about that practice, which is sort of a temporary privileging, I use that term purposely, it comes from a staff member who has no medical training at all, but she works with a set of guides that have been provided to her over the years as we've had PAs request privileges or request procedures, and we've determined through no actual data at all whether or not at what level of supervision a new PA should be allowed to do this procedure versus an experienced PA. We haven't even defined what an experienced PA is. And this is the way decisions are made, both first at the PAC and then at the board level. Unfortunately, I think that it is quite unfortunate that that there's no data that's looked at. It's really just a question of the opinions of the board members. We have tried on the Physician Assistant Committee to live within the confines of the rules as they've been developed. But I found it very difficult, and from time to time, obviously differ with the board in what a PA should be allowed to do. Bottom line is, many other states, the vast majority of other states in the nation have moved away from the sort of older view of PA practice to a more modern view of it. And again, as part of that, most states have adopted, again, the vast majority of states have adopted a physician delegatory law that allows the supervising physician who works with the PA FDA on a regular basis to determine what their competencies and what their abilities should be. And that's really the primary goal here. Again, as someone with about 6 years or 10 years of experience working with this process, I really look forward to a time where this can be monitored in a much safer way for the citizens of Oregon.
Senator Bates. Just a quick couple comments. Mr. Way, thank you for your work in Oak Ridge.
Thank you.
For people like you in rural parts of Oregon, there'd be no health care out there at all, and we do appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you.
Being out there 24-7 by yourself must be a challenge at times.
It's scary sometimes, but
yeah. Okay.
Worth it.
Thank
definitely
you.
Worth
thank
it.
You for doing it. Okay. That said, you know, the range of what PAs do is huge, and as new technologies and new procedures come along, I don't know how a medical board can possibly keep up with those. I have PAs that work with orthopedists to do synvisc injections. I have PAs that work with OB-GYN people helping in surgery, doing things that the other PAs wouldn't be doing. I wouldn't be doing. They've been specially trained for that. And clearly the responsibility in the end doesn't come back to the board. It comes back to the supervising physician, which is usually the ones I know of are very close relationships. We have a PA in our practice who I monitor when her physician who monitors normally is gone, and we sit down and go through 10 to 15% of the charts on a weekly or a biweekly basis. That's mm-hmm. just the way it is. And it's very close monitoring. It's great care for the patients, and I think it's an old-fashioned thing that was put in place when we first started this PA program because we were kind of new and weren't sure what was going to happen, and you know, these people were really properly trained, and they were putting the public at risk. I think we're past all that now. It's time to make a change, and so I'm very supportive of your request here. I don't know how the rest of the members of the committee are. We haven't a chance to talk about it, but it's time to make that change.
This is a no-brainer.
Well, I didn't know where you guys were on this, so I don't know.
No, I mean, this makes total sense.
Well, the board's in the community probably have a little different opinion, so just be prepared.
I think we can be prepared for that, yes.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much. Any other comments?
No,
okay.
No, Alan said it pretty good.
Right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Now what we would like to do is consider...
you've got to go into work session here.
Oh, okay. That will conclude our informational hearing, and now we're going to go into work session with an introduction to committee bills. And you have a list of committee bills, and I know I had mine right here.
Yeah, it looks like this here. Yeah.
Oh, it's right here. Okay. Yeah. We have to limit the number of committee bills that we have this time. We're combining two committees. We have a subcommittee for healthcare reform, and so if there are committee bills that come forward, I really want to know where the stakeholders are at on these. So I'm willing to introduce committee bills, but I really would like to know how controversial it is before it comes, and that means talking to stakeholders. But how would you want to do this, committee?
Well,
all right, let's say, let's look at LC 1561, and basically that's the dental therapist bill, one version of it. Okay, let's go through them all so that we can list them all. I just want to point out...
Well, Madam Chair, it's committee bills have become more of a pro forma thing than I think they probably should be. I think we way overshot last session in the number of committee bills we had as a body. And I've taken a very cursory look at the summaries here. Some of these I don't like. There's no question about that. But our standard has always been you don't have to like it to introduce it. My hope is that none of these is considered gold just because we're introducing it at this point in time. And like I said, some of these I find very troubling, but at this point in time, I think the simplest thing would be, let's just introduce the list and then we'll deal with the merit at a later point in time. We will have that opportunity. Just because it's introduced as a committee bill doesn't mean it goes anywhere.
Are you okay with that, Senator Bates?
Yeah, William, there's other bills that didn't make it to the committee thing, and it doesn't preclude us from looking at those bills later.
Heavens no.
Have a good chance to talk about them, look at them, and some of them may go different committees. I had a large number that were given that they weren't my brainstorms. I wish some of them were, but they weren't. They were brought to us by various people. We can bring them into the committee later. We can drop them into the other committee. Some of them may go directly to Ways and Means. And I frankly like to have a chance to talk with individual members of this committee on some of these bills and make sure we have a clear understanding of them before we went too far. The ones I've looked through here, I wouldn't mind just bringing them as a block today, and with understanding that just because they're a committee bill doesn't mean they go anywhere.
Okay, so if it's the pleasure of the quorum that we have here, I'll make the motion. We'll do this list, and we'll call that good for today. Is that okay?
Yes, okay.
Madam Chair, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 1561, dated 10-22-10; LC 2030, dated 12-1-10. LC 2796, dated 10-26-10, LC 2839, dated 11-12-10, LC 2322, dated 11-18-10, LC 2350, dated 12-8-10, LC 2441, dated 11-10-10, LC 2450, dated 12-1-10, LC 2465, dated 11-30-10, LC 2518, dated 12-7-10, and LC 2673, dated 12-6-10.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved all 11 LCs. I'm not going to repeat them.
Thank you for not that.
Is there any discussion? Okay, no further discussion, and no opposition? So if not, the...
Frank, you know what you're not opposing?
The measures are introduced as committee bills. All right, now, on the agenda, colleagues, I'm recessing, all right?
Yep.
We are recessing, and we will reconvene Thursday at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room F to have the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange and Action Plan for Health, the report heard from the Oregon Health Authority.
Ma'am, Chair, will that be an opportunity to do more than just the exchange, to have a real good discussion with the authority on some of the issues they're dealing with?
We're going to convene at 1. We'll probably be there till midnight.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there's some
summation. That's right. It's going to be short because we've got four sessions.
We have floor session at 3. So this was the only time we could...
The one issue I really want to have a chance to talk about and ask some questions about is the rate setting for managed care plans that's been put out there. Just it needs to be addressed at least for 5 or 10 minutes.
You would need to talk with Amy on what will be introduced. He is wanting to have something else added to the agenda when the Oregon Health Authority reports, and the report was going to be basically the health exchange and action plan, but he also wants to address the rate setting. We've discussed this in this committee before, and I know that Judy Moore Peterson was gone. Yeah, and so that's why we did not have it on the agenda today, and she really needs to be a part of that discussion.
Bruce Goldberg can answer the questions, too. He knows what's going on, but...
Yeah.
Well, think about it, okay? Please.
All right. With that, we are recessed. Thank you, committee.